Hello again, friends, and Happy New Year from the 605 Super Podcast. It's time for another holiday spectacular. What should we call this one? New Year's Star Wars, I guess. I don't know. Is there a New Year's themed? Well, anyway, Scott Cornish is on the line with me right now. Scott, what is there a better thing that I'm missing? I'm not going to do like New Year's Revolution or anything.
Let me think about that. I'll spring something on you as we roll along here. The wheels are turning at all times. You know? Well,
the wheels are going to be turning here on the show because just like last week's Christmas Star Wars special episode, we're going to have multiple guests, multiple friends of the Super Podcast, co-hosts, former guests, and minimal editing, hypothetically. We'll see. I already hear some noises that I'm making that I'm not very happy with. But before we get too far down the line, and there's a lot I want to talk to you about as well as other people, we do have one guest that has a very limited window to speak to us today. So I'm going to make an attempt right now to dial him in. I have my dial pad open. I am... And actually, before we do that, I got a another one of our guests just wrote to me that he's ready. So let me get him on the line first. And... let's see. Do you have any guesses on who you'll be speaking to?
No, I don't. I have a wish list, but no guesses.
Misty Blue is not on your wish list, is she?
Can we just end the Misty Blue?
We know you have a thing for Misty Blue and Linda Dallas, but hold on one second.
I think Misty Blue has a thing.
Well, we now have on the line both John McAdam and star maker Kenny Bolin. Kenny, how are you?
Well, I'm hanging in there. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing all right now that we have you on the line.
Well, didn't you and I just talk like a day or two ago?
We spoke yesterday for about 45 minutes.
Yeah, we spoke yesterday, and I guess we talked a little bit the day before that on the Jim Cornette Experience,
Now
right?
That I think about it, we've been speaking a lot lately, yeah.
Well, apparently we have. Have we become close buddies or something? What has happened?
I think we're getting there. We may have to do our show finally after all this.
I think we have common interests. I think you and I have common things that we like and don't like about certain people, but I guess we probably can't talk about that here, can we?
Probably not at the very second, but you may be right. You may be onto something.
We'll find another day and another time to talk about that, because you think Bucci got it yesterday. I got a little something in store for the person that you and I know that we're talking about.
I have an idea, yes.
He and I are going to have a come to Jesus meeting, and I'm anxious to see how verbally skilled he is, because I don't think he is.
So well, the listeners,
we'll just let the people guess who I may or may not be talking about.
They have no idea what you're talking about.
They probably ain't got a fucking clue, do they? What's the language like on this show? Is it the same as the Jim Cornette Experience?
Yeah, you could say whatever you want.
Same as the bowling alley, then. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Test it out. Do you have anything you want to say real quick?
Now, I heard something about a Cornish hen you've got on here, and you got John McAdams. Now, where's the Cornish hen?
That's me right here, Kenny.
All right. Now, who is the third piss boy? I heard something about a third piss boy.
That's me, Kenny. Joe, Tom Robinson and Joe Lilly used to be pretty tight. I just want to tell everyone, too, I got Kenny's book maybe a year ago, and any listener of Brian's show would love that book. Nothing but hilarious stories. It was great.
You guys aren't going to believe this, but my son accidentally brought the wrong books up here. He was supposed to bring some other stuff to give to my cousin who was coming up here to visit me, and he grabbed the wrong books. He grabbed a stack of my books that were signed by both me and Cornette. I want you to know that I've sold 8 of the 10 books that he brought up here to the staff that's in the hospital at $30 a pop.
Oh, man.
You didn't give any for free to any of the hospital staff. You actually
fuck
sold
no. Oh, fuck no. They ain't giving me shit for free. My insurance company gets paid pretty good for it. You're not going to believe what I'm watching on. I'm so fucking bored right now that I'm watching ESPN Classic Wrestling and Bull Payne. Now, this is to tell you how fucking old this is. Bull Payne was in the ring when he could actually work.
Who's he working with?
That long ago.
Yeah, I guess the 1700s or something. I never knew Bull to have a full head of hair. And apparently Samantha Dundee that was his manager back then?
I believe so.
Because I know there was some controversy about that Bull stole Bill Dundee's wife from him, or girlfriend, or I guess his wife. And that there was some heat between them. And I guess this is during that era, because I was shocked to see Samantha managing him. I never really saw these when they originally aired. I didn't even have cable back then, I don't think. And, but boy, this is a, it's almost like you're watching a real old wrestling show. All the old gimmicks, all the fringe. Everybody was in an Express or a Warrior or something like, you know.
Well, you know what? There was no place more exciting when it was packed than the Dallas Sportatorium. And there's no
I've been there. I was there in the days that Jimmy was there.
And there's no place more dead than the Dallas Sportatorium when it's dead.
Well, I don't know. I'll put the Louisville Gardens up against it. I've done my share of both of those. Thanks to houses that OVW ran and thanks to houses that Jerry Lawler ran. And I've been in there when there was 5,500 people and you couldn't cram another person in there. And I've been in there when about 75 people showed up in a 5,000-seat arena. And that's a lot of fucking fun, too. So, yeah, I've had my share of both. I could see the Sportatorium being very similar to the Louisville Gardens. But, yeah, I did get the great honor of getting to do a couple of those shows when I went down to best man Jimmy Cornette's wedding.
What do you mean you did those shows?
Dennis Coraluza was there, and that's kind of how the relationship with the Piss Boys come to be. If I hadn't met Coraluza, I'd have never met the Piss Boys.
When you say you did those shows, what do you mean?
Well, I didn't do them. I was just traveling around with him. I had just started working for Nick Gulas at that time, and Jimmy invited me to come down to Texas, and I went on the kind of the tour with him while he was there. I went to Broken Bow, Oklahoma. We did the Sportatorium. I also toured with him when he was doing the Louisiana circuit and would go to this. So, no, I can't say doing them. I wasn't performing on them. And I was just down there checking out what Jimmy was doing. And, you know, picking up any little trade secrets I could to take back to do with Gulas' show in Nashville. And I didn't learn shit following Jimmy around. I had to do my own shit. So kind of how that went. So
Ryan, Scott, and I were at the Louisville Gardens when they almost had a for real riot.
Yeah, the last
one. Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Was that Last Dance?
It was August of 95, Smoky Mountain versus USWA.
I was there, too. And I was set on the Smoky Mountain side. And you're right. Those fans took that shit seriously, didn't they?
They did.
But, yeah, I was there as a fan. I just sat on the side, me and my son. Sat on the Smoky side, and we turned on our John Jerry Lawler's side. So all the Lawler, Memphis fans went to one side of the arena, and all the Smoky fans went to the other. And me, Norman Dooley, my son, and a few others joined the Smoky side. And we just never dreamed that there'd be that many Smoky fans there, but there was actually quite a few. And that was a fun show. We had a good time that night. And you're right. I don't recall exactly what the riot was about, but I do remember those fans took it real fucking seriously. And they did not like me switching sides, being as I'd been a loyal, I'd been known in the Louisville Garden since 1974. And then all of a sudden I show up and walk over on the Smoky Mountain side. That wasn't too well appreciated.
Well, you know, one topic I wanted to open up to everyone here, and it's one of the overriding themes here of the show today, is it is New Year's Eve. We are about to usher in a new year, 2017, and I want to ask all three
I'm basically going to be in the hospital 2 years. You believe that? Coming to hospital 2016, I might get out in 2017. Man, that's a hell of a fucking day.
It'll probably be good for your book sales, though.
Well, you never know.
Yeah, well, the question I have for all of you, and we'll start with Scott, is... If you had to pick 1 year, you know, you could be a fan, you could be a performer, you could be a promoter, because I know, John, you promoted your wrestling company for a while there. If you had to pick 1 year that was your favorite year of professional wrestling, what would it be and why? Scott, what do you say?
Well, as a fan, I think it was 1989. The NWA was really exciting. They had I still remember that they came up to Syracuse near where I lived and actually did a house show. Which, if you looked at it now, if you looked at this house show lineup that they had in an old horse barn at the state fairgrounds with a dirt floor, you'd look at that lineup today and you'd go Sting versus Muda, Flair versus Funk, the Midnight Express versus maybe the Freebirds, and on it went. It was a stunning lineup of NWA.
You've already sold me a ticket. I'd have bought a ticket to see that.
Yeah, just an average house show.
That was in a place that looked like a barn with a dirt floor, huh?
Yeah, yeah, it was right up at the state fairgrounds, and the only venue that they had that wasn't like the auditorium downtown where the WWF
sounded like a hell of a card there.
It was fantastic, and but at the time, you know, the NWA had that kind of a roster. I can't, off the top of my head, remember what was going on in the WWF, but I always had an eye on that. Randy Savage was.
89 is when I moved to Atlanta and started hanging out with Jimmy at TBS Studios and getting to know all the NWA guys.
Sure.
The Lugers, the Stings, and the J.J. Dillons and all these guys.
Yeah,
and,
so that's...
And Ric Flair, that's when he and I really got to know... Well, he and I got to know each other pretty well in 86 when we put a bet on the Louisville, North Carolina game. But I interrupted your deal, so go ahead.
No, that's okay. It's far more interesting than what I'm laying out. But the WWF was what I was watching. Randy Savage was on fire at that time. Even though I was, you know, well out of high school and into college and stuff at that time, it still had that feeling. You could see what was going on out of Atlanta. I think we had access to AWA wrestling around here. So for a wrestling fan, there was all kinds of stuff going on, and I still hadn't gotten jaded and older to where I was still excited every time the show came on, you know, and couldn't wait for it to come on week by week. So the shows that I got to see here in Utica were all WWF shows, but they were still a lot of fun. I imagine, let's see who was on those shows. It had to have been Ted DiBiase, Randy Savage. Hogan certainly never came to Utica once he got to be a big star. But it was simply a great time with tons of wrestling on, and just a great time to be a fan.
Well, cable was very well established then. When me and Cornette were watching, we would have to adjust our antenna to various different cities, Indianapolis, Bowling Green, Louisville, Nashville, Cincinnati, and pick up different companies that way. That was our cable TV, was a high-powered antenna. Neither of us ever dreamed if we were ever going to get cable or not. We didn't get it until the early 80s.
Oh, I never saw anything except WWF. What did I know? I didn't ever see anything but WWF from...
what I saw at WWF back then, you didn't know shit then, if that's the case.
That's certainly true.
You knew how to put on a boring-ass three-hour show and give you a 10-minute teaser at the end of the night that you'd never see the finish of.
That's right. But still, you didn't know any different. I mean, if I look back at the first live show that I saw in Utica was in 1980. I was really a latecomer when it came to getting live wrestling because they weren't on the air in Utica, so they didn't do house shows. Yeah. So I didn't see a house show until I was out of high school. And if I looked at that card today, I'd say I wouldn't cross the street to see this show. But at the time, it was the greatest thing I ever saw. The main event, John McAnimal liked this, exciting main event of Pedro Morales defending his Intercontinental title against the Hangman.
Oh, God.
that was our main event.
That was the main event, huh?
That's right.
At Hangman, he sold a lot of tickets. normally to his friends and relatives.
I like how he was billed as being from Europe.
From Europe, yeah.
Hey, guys, I come up with a new, not to interrupt the flow of the story here, but I come up with a new one-liner tonight. There's an ESPN broadcaster who puts me on his radio show from time to time out of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Calls me tonight and asks me when I'll feel like doing a show because he said I sounded so spunky and so upbeat on Cornette's show. So he just figures I'm just ready to do podcast out the ass. So he calls me and asks me if I can do a show, and he says, oh, by the way, he says, you know, I'm a 49er fan. He said, we're getting ready to draft your guy. I said, what do you mean you're going to draft my guy? I said, who are you talking about? He said, we're going to draft Lamar Jackson. I said, well, no, you're not, because he's staying at Louisville for one more year. Oh, my God, really? Well, we thought he was coming out. I said, no, he's not coming out. I said, you're a 49er fan, huh? I said, you guys suck so bad, you got to be called the 69ers. And he fucking died. He said he's never heard that before. It just came to me out of the blue. Has anyone ever called the 49ers the 69ers because they suck so bad? I think they should. But I just wanted to get that out there because he said that he was going to tell it five times and give me credit for it. And then after that, he was going to claim he came up with it. So I got to get it out there as much as I can before he ruined what I thought was a goddamn funny one-liner. So if you know anybody... Oh, and by the way, Jimmy Cornette's wife loves the San Francisco 49ers.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to be hearing this real soon. Even though
they'll
she did
rat, the Niners will stick next
did,
year too. They'll get a little more.
Even though she did rat Bucci out for me and him wishing me dead. And if y'all haven't heard the experience yet, I'm begging you to hear it.
I can't wait.
God. Now let's hear the other. Who just got done speaking there?
That was the Cornish.
That was Cornish Hen. That was Cornish Hen. let's hear Piss Boy 3. Let's hear Piss Boy's 3 favorite year, and then I'll chime in.
Okay, it's tough, but I'm going to say 1982.
Well, that's fantastic. Now, here's what I got.
I was 16, 17 years old. We all had our driver's licenses, finally had cars and all that good stuff. We went to all the Boston Garden shows. We went to a whole bunch of local shows.
I got my license, and I was 22. No, I got mine at 19. I was told I could have a car and a license when I could afford to buy it. So, hell, me and you might not be as far off as I thought we were.
No, and the other reason is, I mean, we finally, October 81, we finally got WTBS on cable. So, 82 was the first full year of Georgia wrestling for me.
Then we got Southwest
on USA. So,
yeah. Yeah, that's about when me and Cornette got it, was around 82.
Everyone got it at the right time. Everyone got it right when Piper came in.
Exactly.
Piper was something else, man. Jimmy loved him. He liked him even better than I did. And I remember being very upset because a big match with Jerry Lawler and Piper was supposed to happen in Atlanta. And if I ain't mistaken, Piper got pulled over and caught with cocaine in his trunk. And the match never happened. Do y'all recall that?
I remember Piper doing promos on Atlanta TV about the match.
The build-up was great. Hell, I was going to go to Atlanta and buy a ticket to see Piper and Lawler. I couldn't wait to see it. But if I remember correctly, he got pulled over, had coke in his car, and the match never happened.
Yeah, Ole fired him for a drug-related incident, and I believe that may have been it.
That may have been the one, huh? Well, I don't know what the people in Atlanta were thinking about it, but I know from us hearing about it up here, we were real excited about it. And Cornette's one of the biggest Piper fans that ever lived. I would say that's definitely one of his top three favorites was Roddy Piper.
Sure.
No, the story I heard was that Piper and Rich were showing up like really late every night, completely screwed up, and only felt like he had to get rid of one of them.
If Rich was with him, there was definitely some cocaine in the car.
Allegedly.
Erase all that doubt.
Allegedly.
Allegedly, hell.
Yeah. Yeah, you better cover yourself. He might try to sue you.
Sue me, Tommy. Sue me. I'm on disability. You can't touch me. I'm like MC Hammer. You can't touch this.
Well, John, you were saying that's what you had heard, that Tommy Rich and Piper were showing up late every single night, and Ole finally got fed up.
Yeah, they were. I mean, those two were in the the main events, the last match and the second to last match. And they were showing up like all messed up at like 10 o'clock, and they're trying to stretch out the card to waiting for these guys to show up. And I guess Ole valued Rich more than Piper, and it was kind of a send the message thing. That's what I heard.
I'm shocked Ole tolerated that one day. He didn't take much shit. I am shocked he put up with any shit, whether it was Piper or Rich or not. He just didn't seem to put up with much shit.
And he liked firing people.
Yeah, but let's be fair, too. This is 82 before he ousted Jim Barnett at Christmas time. And even if you take all of those, nasty rumors out of the equation, who's Jim Barnett going to let Ole
nasty, those nasty rumors that might be true.
who's Jim Barnett going to allow Ole to fire? Piper, who had only been there a short time, or Rich, who had been a major draw since the late 70s?
Yeah, he actually did very well up here, Tommy did. Him and Lawler had the hell of a feud, and I remember they actually had the CWA world title match on Memphis TV, and Lawler burnt Rich with a fire and burnt his stomach and lit him up and everything. Of course, we all believed it, and that was a big deal. Tommy was a real good draw up here. But I remember Tommy Rich when we would see after the shows were over, me and Lawler would meet at McDonald's. And he always bought me a Big Mac and a Big Red, and we'd bullshit while Dundee went and got laid or got drunk somewhere, and Tommy Rich was out trying to get some tail. And so me and Jerry, not every week, but, maybe two times a month, we'd go to McDonald's and hang out and bullshit. And I remember that we're driving there, and the girl that was driving me there, her name was Lola, and she was doing the referee, Tommy Marlin. Well, Tommy Rich saw her and had a fit over her. He liked Lola. So they pull up beside us on the way to Neff's, this little liquor place off of near U of L. And Tommy Rich was sticking out his tongue trying to do oral sex with Lola as he's driving down the road. He's giving simulated oral to Lola. And Tommy Rich was about 19 years old at the time. And I'm thinking, well, he's a real fucking class act. And then I found out he's into the coke and everything else. And he was into that shit even when he was like 19. And yeah, he was his that little image he had on TV and what he really was two different worlds.
Well, Kenny, let me ask you this.
I remember Tommy working Smoky Mountain with Jimmy, and I don't recall day one I ever saw him that he looked like he could function a match by the time the bell rung. He was normally asleep, passed out, or fucked up in the locker room every time I saw him. Jimmy even had me crawl in the ring and save him towards some of the last shows at Smoky. I dove in the ring and threw my body on him because Jimmy asked me to. And because the heels were beating the shit out of him. They turned on him because he was a heel down there. And so, yeah, I actually saved Tommy Rich once. I'll never do it again.
I'm sure he ended up that way after spending a couple nights with Tom Robinson. But let me ask you this, Kenny. You brought up that
allegedly
that Lawler threw the fire at Tommy Rich. You being a major fan of Memphis wrestling, someone who really idolized Jerry the King Lawler, when did you first find out about Flash Paper and exactly how fire was thrown?
God, probably 77, probably well after I'd met him. And I didn't know how the fuck he was throwing it. I didn't know about Flash Paper. I would say every bit of 77 at the earliest. Cause I know when he did it to Rich, we were just know he reached in his tights and all of a sudden fire would come out. But of course, I was also raised on the Sheik. I watched him on Channel 4 in WTTV in Indianapolis. And this is how my dad viewed it. Memphis was the phony shit. Memphis was that phony wrestling. The real wrestling was Dick the Bruiser, the Crusher, the Legionnaires, the Sheik.
Oh, boy.
Cowboy Frankie Lane, Pepper Gomez, all these guys, because that was an arena setting and not a studio. Sam Miniker was the commentator, and the atmosphere was phenomenal. The opening theme to their show was great, and it was just two different worlds of wrestling. But that's how my dad viewed it. But yet he hated Jerry Lawler with a passion. When Lawler would cut a promo, he'd get so mad. And of course, I loved Lawler. I said, man, that's what I want to do. I want to be able to piss people off like that one day. And I knew that at like 12 years of age, that I wanted to be just like Jerry Lawler. And, every Saturday I lived to see Jerry Lawler on TV. So I was going to tell you my favorite years were probably 74. When Jerry came back here and got a decent run going and became the king. And that was when the feuds were going on with Jackie Fargo, which were the fucking best. And then again, probably 76, 77, when he had the King's Army going and he had Plowboy Frazier and little bits going on with Jerry Jarrett. But the King's Army was a great era in 76. The Bicentennial Baby, Big Bad John, was in here to feud with Bill Lawler. And, oh, he was something else. And you talk about a guy who couldn't work a fucking leg but was as over with the fans as you'll ever get. Plowboy Frazier, another one, you know. So you get Plowboy and Big Bad John in the territory at the same time. Just two big seven-foot sumbitches that couldn't work worth a nickel, and the fans fucking either loved them or hated them. Because eventually they turned Plowboy babyface as well. But probably 74, 76 would be my very favorite eras.
Sure.
I loved Jerry as a babyface too, just because the promos were still great, but nothing like Lawler as a heel. And my son is just still getting caught up on all the great Lawler heel promos that were done. And one of the better ones done is when Lawler and Mantell were going back and forth, and neither was really established as a heel or a face. They were both sort of babyfaces, but going back and forth at each other, you'd swear they're both heels. And they hate, and I think they legit really did not like each other very well. And one of these days, Dutch is a good friend of mine, so I can't tell the one story I know that would really piss Jerry Lawler off. We'll talk about that in private one day, I guess. Because I guess, because Dutch can probably still whip my ass, but I'll just leave it alone. It ain't like Bucci. You know, there's a lot of people who whip Bucci's ass, but I ain't going to take my chances against Dutch Mantel. So, now, Piss Boy 3, have you ever met Bucci?
I don't even know who Bucci is, sir.
Well, there you go. Well, that's kind of the feedback I've been getting on Facebook today. There's been people Googling trying to figure out who he is, and I've had people write me, this piece of shit's Mike Bucci, this irrelevant motherfucker. And the fans have just been going off on him, man. It's just been something terrible. But well, I assumed, being as he was a Jersey boy, that Piss Boy would know who he is.
Well, John's not a Jersey boy. He doesn't have that mark on his
record. Oh, well, he's not a real Piss Boy. But he ain't a Jersey boy.
Kenny, John, let me ask you guys both a question, because Scott and I were talking about it a little earlier when we were recording next week's episode of the Super Podcast. You brought up Bill Dundee, and you brought up after the shows you wanted to get drunk or laid, and it made me think of this.
I can't think of any show that he didn't have one or the other or both on the mind. That's pretty much a constant.
Have either of you seen Bill Dundee's current car?
Just about an hour ago.
He passed us on the road going to Memphis when we were going down there to, or not Memphis, but Jackson. And he passed us on the road, and I swear to God, it looked like something I'd do. I'm pissed that he stole my idea. He fucking beat me to it, that's all I can tell you, because my car should look like that.
But yes,
I've seen that car.
But here's the question. His car, you know, for those of you who don't know, it has a giant picture of Bill Dundee reclining on the side of it, and it says, Superstar Bill Dundee, for bookings, call this number. The question is, who's driving on the road saying, oh, you know what? We should book Bill Dundee. And for what?
Book Bill Dundee. Now, he's older than Lawler. Lawler is, let's see, I'm 56, so Lawler's 66. Lawler, I guess, turned 67 in November.
I think so, Dundee's in his 70s, isn't he?
Yeah, Dundee's in his 70s, and he still works. And as bad as I hate to admit it, he still don't look too bad. But look at Lawler. Does Lawler look like a 66-year-old man?
No.
No. And him and Terry Funk put on one of the most entertaining matches that I'd seen in quite some time down in Jackson, Tennessee. They stole the whole goddamn show. There was an average of about 140 years worth of man in the ring, and they stole the show. Lawler threw fire, caught Funk's hair on fire. Funk was, that son of a bitch tried to fly me. He was back in the locker room screaming at the top of his lungs because Funk's hair caught fire on legit. And he goes, son of a bitch trying to fraud me. He's back here doing his Funk screech that he does. And that was back in the locker room where no one was really supposed to be able to hear him. But we had stepped back there, and he, oh, God, Lawler got him good, man. And I guess Lawler's flash paper has gotten better over the years. I don't know. But, yeah, 140 years with a man in the ring. And then Dundee just came by to hang out. He didn't even work. And but I just can't fathom that 70-year-old men want to get in the ring and do this shit. I didn't want to do it when I was in my 30s. You know why? Because it fucking hurt. They'd force me in the ring about once every 2 months, so the baby faces could get the payoff and get me in some type of a six-man tag or whatever. And, shit. I realized that talking was a hell of a lot easier than taking bumps every goddamn night. So
you know what it is? It's all they know. It's the lifestyle that they've lived their entire lives, and they're not going to change until they absolutely have to.
You're right. Bucci used to claim that he just could not fathom that people couldn't let this business go. I'm retired. I'll never be associated with this business again. I'm a banker. That life has passed me. And he takes every fucking booking he can get for $75. Why? Because they can't let it go. I might be one of the only ones that's really, once I retired, never did a show. Heavily to do because it takes too much out of me to try to get the one. Jimmy will tell me about these shows or these conventions you can go to, and when I hear how far you have to walk, drag your luggage, park here, park there, walk, set up a table, I can't do all that shit. And it just takes way too goddamn much out of me. Now, hopefully in time I might get back to there, but my days of doing that shit ended about 10 years ago.
Well, we may need you at the Super Podcast convention over the summer.
What is it going to be?
It'll probably be either in New York or New Jersey.
Well, if Cornette goes, we may make a possibility out of that. Cause
boom, there it is.
I have sleep apnea, and I can't drive very far. I'm restricted to about a 45-mile radius on my own. But I can't believe Jimmy at his age likes driving as much as he does. That son of a bitch drive to Vegas before he'd fly. I think he tried to find a route to England by land and didn't have no luck. But I'm amazed that he can drive as far as he does, as much as he does. It used to wear me out to go to London, Kentucky and back, and that's about a 6-hour round trip, maybe 7 at best. And I remember in my 30s, I didn't like doing that trip. But now Jimmy, he just went to Nashville last night, went down there and did a show with Jeff Jarrett, a bot show in Nashville for the Tennessee Volunteers and Nebraska Cornhuskers. It was a bot show just for the football team. And I think Animal, if Hawk managed, we have a story. Animal managed one team, and Jimmy managed another. I forgot who he said it was. You might remember, Brian, or did he tell you?
I don't remember. I mean, it could have been the Heat Seekers because he always
mentions it. It was the Heat Seekers. That's who it was because I asked him how good they were. He said they're nice guys.
And now the world knows.
And now the world knows how nice the Heat Seekers are. God damn, I'm going to hear it for that one. They're nice guys, everybody. That's all I'm saying. If you want to evaluate their talent, that's up to you. Oh, boy. I'm on medication. I know not what I say.
Kenny doesn't have to seek the heat.
It just finds me most of the time. Just like Bruce Pritchard. He'll find me eventually.
Well, I'm well impressed that you fired off that 49-69 joke from your hospital bed.
Right from the hospital bed. It just came to me immediately. And I'm thinking, that's such an easy joke. How have I never heard that before? I've never heard it. And I'm thinking, it just came to me. They suck so bad, they ought to be the 69er. Well, number one, it's a dirty joke. How many places can you really tell it at? But if that joke's ever been done, I sure as fuck never heard it. So I'm taking credit for it. Y'all heard it from me first.
Hey, Kenny, one thing I wanted to talk to you about, you know, when John was first on the Super Podcast, he was
John
on
who?
John McAdam, who's on the line with you right now.
Oh.
When he was first on the show, it was for the Dennis of the Week segment. And he talked about Dennis Carluzzo, who he got to know.
I thought you might have meant John Cena. I didn't know.
No. He's not allowed on the show.
Okay. Well, there you go.
But I believe John McAdam first got to know Dennis in 1988 in Memphis at the UAWF convention. And
we probably met down there then because I was there.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I was there. That's when the Piss Boys were formed. That is when someone lost $10,000 worth of credit cards and someone else went shopping. Piss Boys picked up a little merchandise out of that. Corluzzi got some merchandise. I remember another guy did real well. A kid who went on to become known as the Prince Bowen, heard he did pretty good out of it.
Boy,
I think a camcorder was bought. Cameras, wait, digital equipment.
Wait. A camcorder was bought. How old was your son at that point, 1988?
I didn't say he bought it.
No, but it was bought for it. You said he made out pretty good. He got a camcorder.
No, I said a camcorder was bought. I didn't say who got it.
Okay.
If I remember correctly, I'll tell you one thing that the Prince ended up out of that shopping spree. He got a underdog action figure. Corluzzi had bought him a Philadelphia Eagles football shirt, and he claimed himself, Corluzzi declared himself the god uncle to my son. So that's when we decided to just god everybody up. We gave him god aunts, godfathers, god stepdads, and hopefully they'd all donate money, but a lot of them didn't. So, Corluzzi was officially Christopher's, my son's real name's Christopher, his god uncle was Dennis Corluzzi, the only god uncle he actually had.
Well, that was also the weekend when professional wrestling superstar Kevin Von Erich received a phone call from Jamie Dundee, which messed up his flight plans or something.
Give me more on that one. I didn't hear that.
For no real reason, we were just up way too late and we were having too much fun, and Tom and I were trying to get our pictures taken with Von Erichs, and we didn't. So I don't know why, but I just called Kevin Von Erich pretending to be Jamie Dundee, and I had him on the phone for an hour.
You're kidding me.
I wish I were.
Let me hear your Jamie Dundee impression.
Wait a minute. This is from like 30 years ago, but I'll try.
Well, let's do. I think it's important to point out here. This is not JC Ice Baby. This is not PG-13. This is Jamie Dundee in 1988 before he was really doing much. So it's a different Jamie Dundee.
He's probably doing a little refereeing on Memphis TV, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was kind of doing the Bill Dundee's like 17-year-old son kind of gimmick thing.
There you go. I recall that time.
All right, so I just get on my phone. I'm like, "Hi, this is Kevin Von Erich. Hey, brother, it's Jamie Dundee. How you doing?" I called him brother like 10 times, so he believed
it
was
you can't
me.
You can't talk to a wrestler from the 70s or 80s and not call him brother. You just can't do it.
Yeah.
Well, if it's a Dundee, you can call him daddy. Isn't it? I mean, we talked about this on the show.
Yeah, Bill Dundee, daddy would work on Dundee.
Yeah, Bill Dundee gets away with calling people daddy, but why did that start? And in what situation in real life could you get away with calling another man daddy?
Well, you know what Jackie Fargo made famous, don't you?
Pally?
Pally.
Yeah, Pally. I think that's
stupid. Let me tell you something, Pally. Well, what Pally do you want to beat the shit out of? Let me tell you something, Pally. I'm going to beat you from pillar to post. I'll leave you bleeding in a pool of your own blood, Pally.
But so you see,
why would he be your pal? I don't understand that.
But you see, Fargo can get away with it because of his voice. This is what I said earlier, actually, when me and Scott were recording. Because if you say, "Let me tell you something, Pally," that works. But if you go, "I want to tell you what I'm going to do to you, Pally," it doesn't work the same.
Well, or if Fargo, "Let me tell you what I'm going to do to you, Daddy," then that takes a whole other flavor, too. So, yeah, I guess Dundee could get by with it and Fargo couldn't.
I mean, I just imagine.
Fortunately, Lawler was not a daddy guy. I did hear him sneak a few Pallys in from time to time. son, Lawler was real good at calling people son. Let me tell you something, son. And so, yes, son was Lawler's hick era when Lawler was real Southern.
His hick era.
He had a hick era. He may not want to admit it, but do you watch the real early stuff of Lawler and White? He was as Southern as the day is long. I don't know where his Cleveland roots were, but they weren't in his Memphis wrestling. He's apparently in Memphis a lot longer than he was in Cleveland. And it's a lot like me. You go back and find some old tapes of me from really before I got in wrestling. I had a much more kind of country hickish accent and dialect than I do now. Lawler has evolved immensely from his early 20s. You got to remember, me and Lawler became friends when he was 24 years old. I was 14. I guarantee you, I was nowhere near ready for the stage and spotlight he had when I was 24, for me to have tried to done what he was doing, the main event, 12,000 seat houses, the most hated guy in the South. Everywhere he went was a sold out show. Went to Texas a lot and fought. I mean, this was before that triple brand merger tried to happen. I'm talking about when he would go there and, I think Carlos Colon, he'd go there and fight from time to time. But and for everybody that was anybody in wrestling to come to Memphis to fight him, and he was 24, 25, 26 years old. And to me, that is amazing to basically be, you know, he was the ticket. If Jerry wasn't on the card, those houses were half the size, especially once it got established that him and Fargo feud had ended because now you don't have Fargo to draw the houses anymore. So now you got to have Jerry, and they just kept people coming in left and right, be it Austin Idol, Jimmy Valiant, Joe LaDuke, The Sheik, Dick the Bruiser. There was always some big fucking name coming here, and eventually Hulk Hogan, who had been here before and was a flop, and Lawler didn't have to go anywhere. Pardon?
But when he was there in 79, it flopped?
Well, he was a flop when he was here as Terry Boulder, excuse me.
He was there as Terry the Hulk Boulder in the summer of 79.
Yeah, he was fucking horrible. Jarrett couldn't get rid of him quick enough. This is a true story. I was at Rupp Arena. I guess I was about 18, 19, getting ready to graduate high school. and Jerry was trying to get promos out of them in the back in Lexington. They were filming promos to go to WLEX television. And I think they were on about take 54 with Terry Bolder. We never dreamed he was going to be Terry Hulk Hogan. We never knew that was coming. And, of course, Beefcake was here as Eddie Bolder, his brother. And I think they got on about take 54. And I'd been sitting there watching, and I was turning around biting my lip at how many interviews he had fucked up. And Jerry got pissed at him. He says, Terry, Kenny, sitting over there, is not even in this business. If I tell him, Kenny, you're going to fight Bill Dundee down at the Louisville Gardens Tuesday night, I'd like for you to take a minute to tell me what you're going to do to Bill on Tuesday night. Kenny, what are you going to do? So he had me cut a promo. And I did about a minute. I don't know if I was right to the second on it, because they weren't really counting me down. I did the promo for Jerry. Hogan looks at me, big-eyed, looks over at Lawler. Lawler says, and that's how you do it. And then I think about six takes later, Hogan finally got what Lawler wanted out of him.
That's a sweet story, Kenny.
So that is, now I haven't told that to a lot of people, because number one, I doubt anybody will fucking believe it, but it's the God's honest truth. That was when he was Terry Bolder. Beefcake was there. Jarrett couldn't wait to get rid of them. Hogan couldn't give you a 5-minute match if his life depended on it. The promos, they're on one. When I used to sell the DVD Memphis Classics, that was what opened up, was the debut of Terry Hulk Bolder, whatever the fuck they were calling him then. And then eventually Eddie Bolder, his brother, came in, and which ended up being Brutus the Barber Beefcake. But that was only trumped by the Blade Runners. And I guess I'm sure you've heard the stories of the Blade Runners.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Which were Sting and Dingo Warrior, more or less. And then who got to be two of the biggest fucking names in the business? So we really had three of the biggest names in the history of wrestling here in Memphis. I say we, they, because I wasn't under contract with them. But Hulk Hogan, Brutus the Barber Beefcake, Sting, and Ultimate Warrior were all here, and Jarrett basically said these guys are never going to make a dime in this business and shift them. So even the geniuses fuck up. I'm always pointing out when Jimmy blew it. Jimmy said Paul London would never see a day in the WWE. He said that Johnny Nitro or Johnny Morrison, whatever he became, would never see a day in the WWE. A few others he's really missed the boat on, and I always pointed them out. Well, even Jerry Jarrett blew four big ones. We had all of them here, and he couldn't wait to get rid of them. And the Blade Runners were probably still to this day the worst tag team in the history of Memphis wrestling. They were fucking horrible. And then the next time we see him, you know, he's the Dingo Warrior, and then he makes it to the WWE and he's the Ultimate Warrior. And then of course the Psycho Sid got a lot of his development and fame down here too. But that was four that got away. You know, when Hogan left here, we didn't think we'd ever see him again. Well, you know when the next time was we saw him? He was Thunderlips in the goddamn Rocky movie. And we're going, wait a minute, that's the motherfucker that was here. And it just blew us away that that was the same guy. And so we don't know where that promo skill came from. I guess when he learned to say brother, because Jerry wasn't really having him say brother a whole lot here. And there's some tape floating around of him doing interviews with Lance Russell. And, oh, my God, he was terrible.
Well, Kenny, on that topic, who is someone you saw in Memphis that you were certain would have gone on to bigger things, would have been a major star that it didn't work out for?
Some people wanted to say that Jerry Bryant should have been a big star because he was so similar to Jerry Lawler. They had similar builds, similar physical characteristics, but sometimes you have it and sometimes you don't, and Jerry Bryant was an excellent mid-card to opening card wrestler. He was a good addition to the show. And even Lawler gave him a lot of his tights. I'd see Jerry Bryant wrestle. I said, well, fuck, I know those tights. Those are Jerry's. And but not that I thought he was going to make it, because I didn't. Let me think on that a second. We might have to divert this one of our other guests here and let them kill some time while I think on that. Because really, really, most of the guys that I thought were going to make it did. I never thought Hogan was going to make it. I knew Eddie Boulder wasn't going to make it. He was 10 times worse than Terry. And Dingo Warrior, and I forget what they were called, the Blade Runners. I don't know what names they were given. Do you guys remember?
I think they were Rock and Blade.
I think they originally came in as their real names, Jim Hellwig and Steve Borden.
Oh, okay. There was no way in hell either one of those were ever going to make it in the wrestling business.
And then they turned, and I think they were Rock and Flash, maybe?
I don't even remember that.
Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't.
I'm sitting here watching the 1-2-3 kid on this old ESPN Classic Wrestling. I didn't know he was down there.
Oh, yeah, in Global. Oh, well. Yeah, in 91 he was.
I didn't know that. He was in a red outfit, and I saw him get up, and he had short hair and didn't know who the fuck he was. Here's a story for you. You want to hear about when the 1-2-3 kid tried to purchase drugs for me? And let's remember, I'm not a drug dealer.
Sure.
I was backstage at the Louisville Gardens. They were in here when he was doing the 1-2-3 kid gimmick, and I didn't know that he was into drugs. I had no clue. Well, Jimmy didn't make it here that night. For whatever reason, Jimmy didn't make it. So I'm backstage at the Gardens and hanging out with whoever, probably Owen Hart and a few of those guys that we were really close to, Ken Shamrock, guys like that. And all of a sudden, apparently the word got out that I worked for Humana. Well, Humana was two things here. It was a large hospital chain, but I worked for the insurance division. I sold insurance and recruited nurses and doctors to work in Humana hospitals. That was my job. Well, when he heard I worked for Humana, he and his little pea brain assumed that I had access to drugs. Now, people have confronted him on this, and he swears to God it never happened, and he doesn't even know who I am. Well, he might not. A lot of druggies don't remember people they've met before, so maybe he don't remember me. But backstage at the Louisville Gardens, he come up to me and says, hey, you the guy that works for Humana? I said, yeah. You the guys is tight with Cornette, right? Yeah, well, that's me, but Jimmy ain't here tonight, as you well know. Yeah, man, I was wondering, I need some pills. I hear you can get me the hookup. I looked at him, I said, excuse me? I said, what type of pills are you looking for? And I don't understand what he's telling me, because during that time, I had no clue about drugs or pills or hydrocodone or any of that shit. And I said, buddy, I said, I work for the insurance division. I don't work for hospitals. I said, I'm afraid I can't be of any help to you. So he looks disgusted and walks away, and I think it's the last time I ever had a physical word with him. I call Cornette, and I said, Jimmy, I said, this fucking 1-2-3 kid come up to me wanting to buy some pills from me. He said, why the fuck did he do that? I said, well, he heard I worked for Humana, and he was wanting to know if I had a connection on some pills. He said, well, that's like that stupid motherfucker. He said, I ain't shocked any. So Jimmy apparently knew of his deal, but I didn't know that he was hooked on all that shit back then. I had no clue. Allegedly. Yeah, being as we're throwing that word around.
That's a good word to throw around right now.
But yeah, so that was my only... But apparently, the other thing that I laid claim to, because I don't know who said it. Remember, I laid claim to the San Francisco 69ers joke tonight. That's mine. I don't know anyone else ever said it. That's mine. Well, the other one that I came up with years ago, back when I lived in a tiny one-bedroom apartment, when I'd moved out of my four-bedroom house, I come up with the term X-Pac heat. And that's the type of heat to where just go away. We don't hate you. We don't like you. We just want you to go away. And I remember when he would come down, they weren't be the booze of heat. They were the booze, not this piece of shit again. And I was doing a podcast, and I said, yeah, I said, that's some bitch. He ain't got nothing but X-Pac heat. But everybody immediately knew what I was talking about. Yeah, he's got that fucking shit where they just don't even want you to be on the card. So someone told him, we think Kenny Boland came up with the phrase X-Pac heat. I don't even know who Kenny Boland is. I said, well, tell him he's the motherfucker that he tried to buy drugs from and to buy the Louisville Garden. tell him who Kenny Boland is. And of course, he claimed he'd never met me, never heard of me. Well, how many people know Jimmy Cornette that have never heard of me? Even before I got in wrestling, if you knew Jimmy Cornette, you knew who I was. Because Jimmy would always tell some stupid story of our childhood. Vince McMahon knew of me years before I got into business. Because of hearing Jimmy tell fucking stories. And when he met me, Vince McMahon, the first time I ever met him was backstage at Freedom Hall. And we were there to have a couple of matches before Raw went on the air. Jimmy takes me up to Vince. He says, "Vince, I want you to meet him. Here he is. Here's Kenny Bowen." Vince looked at me. "Oh, my God. You're fucking real." And I looked at him. I said, why wouldn't I be? "We were convinced that Jimmy was making this shit up. We didn't even think you existed. Holy shit, you're fucking real." And I said, "Well, Vince, I said, well, Mr. McMahon, I just want to tell you what a pleasure it is to meet you. I was doing, who were the two guys? God damn it, the ones that got in trouble for selling the T-shirts. No, that Hebners. Was the Hebners. No, that was the Hebners. Who was the one that always called him Mr. McMahon? Who was
Jerry
that
Jerry Briscoe.
Jerry Briscoe. So I'm doing my Jerry Briscoe. And I said, "Well, Mr. McMahon, it's just such a pleasure to meet you here today." And I said, "I'm glad to know that you're real, too." And he says, "Oh, my God, not another one. Not another Briscoe. Jimmy, get him out of here." So he shakes my hand and grins. And that was my first ever meeting with Vince McMahon was, "Oh, my God, he's fucking real."
It's very similar to the relationship Big Bird had with Mr. Snuffleupagus on Sesame Street, where for many years, Big Bird would talk to Mr. Hooper and his various friends, David and everyone, Mr. Snuffleupagus, and no one ever saw him. They just thought Big Bird had an imagination.
Well, that's what I was to Vince. And, well, Pritchard knew me from Jimmy's wedding, so Pritchard knew I was real. But many of the people in the WWE that had never met me would only hear Jimmy tell the stories riding up and down the road. "Well, me and Kenny did this. Well, I remember in 76, me and Kenny did this where we wrestled up on a roof. Well, we wrestled in a high school and we drew a bigger crowd and so-and-so." And so Jimmy always had, and everybody does Jimmy in a high-pitched voice. And so when Pritchard is actually the funniest telling the Jimmy Cornette story, because he always gives that big-ass high-pitched voice and trying to impersonate Jimmy and all the stories that he's told about me and him. But yeah, there's a lot of people in the WWE that just thought I was a figment of Jimmy's imagination. They didn't even think I was real. So so that was just so funny for Vince to say that. And actually, I never ever had a negative word or problem with Vince. I met him a few times after that. Christopher, I got some heat in the back one night at one of the other shows we were doing at Freedom Hall. And I'd gotten permission to bring Chris with me that night because I didn't have access to a sitter. And I pretty much took Chris everywhere I went anyway. I only had, you know, 2 or 3 days a week with him at that time. So if I went, Chris went. And I asked Danny and Jimmy if it was okay if Chris came with me. "Sure, yeah. He can just sit out there and see. Fuck, he knows what all is going on." And Chris was like 8, 9 years old, whatever. So he just sat out in the seats and watched all the guys go over their matches and everything. So a security tried to throw Chris out because I'm backstage going over the shit I got to do that night. I think that was the last show that I ever did in Freedom Hall. And that night I shared a locker room with Rock, Billy Gunn, a couple of others. I forget everybody that was back there, but I do remember that I shared a locker room with The Rock that night. And I remember knowing The Rock when he was Flex Cabana, making less than $300 a week working for Lawler. And now he's one of the biggest stars in the business. He ain't quite $40 million a year actor Rock, but he's still pretty big, and we know he's probably not going to be in the WWE much longer. So that was an honor for that to be my last WWE show. So I go to catering, and I'm getting ready to sit down, and me and Kane and Cornette and a couple of other, you know, the old Smoky connection, we're over on one side of the table eating, and on the left side of us, exactly adjacent from us, is Vince, Stephanie, and a couple of others are sitting there. Next thing I know, my son, I see off in the distance, they're trying to escort him out of the building. He's fucking like 9 years old. And Rico Constantino was on the card that night. And Rico goes, no, he says, he's good. He says, I know who that is. And then Jerry Lawler walked up. He said, yeah, I know who that kid is. He belongs to that guy sitting right over there. So Lawler points up. He said, no, let him go. He's fine. So Lawler and Rico save Chris from getting thrown out. And they send him over to catering where we're at. And Chris comes over and, yeah, Dad, they told me I wasn't allowed to be out there, and he tried to throw me out. I said, well, just hang here with me, Chris, until we figure out what to do with you. And then Vince looks over, and hey, is that your son? I said, yes, that's my son, Chris. Come on over here, boy. Come on over here and see me. So Chris goes over. The next thing I know, Vince offers Christopher a seat. Chris is sitting there at the table with him. I'll be goddamn, he's over there eating with Vince and Stephanie and a couple other people they had over there with him that I can't place who they were. And me and Kane and Jimmy was in there. He said, your goddamn son's over there fucking eating with Vince McMahon. And here you said, I said, I know. I've been trumped by my own fucking son. So I thought it was pretty cool that Chris was getting to hang out with Ben. Now, Stephanie was just kind of getting her feet wet at being a cunt. That just had got started. And because she was real sweet before she got into business. Everybody loved her. She was just sweet as she could be. And I remember that was the night that we had to talk them into keeping Rico and Cena, because Vince didn't think Cena had what it took, and even recorded himself on the My Life DVD saying that, so that's documented. And Rico had really officially been let go. And then Stone Cold Steve Austin got with us and said, hey, he said, I like that Rico cat. And he says, how do you guys feel about Cena? I said, well, fuck, he's a natural born star. You know, of course, Jimmy and Danny say the same thing. So Austin sets up a meeting with Stephanie and says, hey, you've already cut this cat loose and you're about to cut Cena. Why don't you put him on the damn roster for 90 days? You're paying them anyway. And let's see what they're made of. Now, I never got to that point with Cena because he hadn't officially been let go yet, but it was being talked about. Cena don't know that, and I don't know if even Danny or Jimmy will admit it, but Vince basically did. He said, I didn't get it. I didn't see any talent in Cena. And recording. If you watch the My Life DVD, because I'm on it too, didn't get paid, but I'm on it. Well, I sort of didn't get paid because I sold a shitload of those son of bitches at my own rate. And didn't have to get a percentage either. Well, I didn't have to take a percentage. You know, I got 100% of the proceeds. So it didn't work out too bad. And then I made, of course, that was My Life. And then I made Our Life, which was a 4-hour DVD of me and Cena and our early stages of OVW. And then I made The Rest of Our Life, which was another 4-hour DVD, which built to the part where I fought Cena in a Loser Leave Town match. So between those three DVDs, I did okay.
Well, one of these days, I definitely need to get this Days of Our Life DVD set from you.
The days of our lives, my life, right. Our life, and the rest of our life. Well, one of them was WWE bad, so I really didn't sell as many of those because people were more interested in the OVW shit than they were the WWE shit. And so I sold a boatload more of the ones I made. And, of course, they didn't like that because they claimed they owned all the footage. I said, yeah, but you don't own me, and I'm on all that footage, too. And I never signed a waiver. So Danny says, well, I signed the waiver basically for all the talent at OVW. I said, well, I don't think legally you can do that. And I had three different attorneys tell me, no, he cannot sign your image away. It might have been his show, but it's your image. And I'm still waiting for the day that an attorney feels froggy enough to... Because I don't know if you guys know this. I was on... Boy, I'm dominating this whole fucking show, ain't I?
Yeah, we're about to say goodbye to you.
Well, no, you're not. 27 weeks in a row, I was on in the Philippines recently. I mean, over the summer. They were showing matches of me and Cena in its entirety on their version of SmackDown in the Philippines. Wouldn't you think I would be entitled to a little something?
Yes.
Well, there's no answer out of anybody there.
You would think so. You would think so.
So,
yes.
So basically, Steve Austin saved Cena's and Rico's job. Rico got another 4.5 years out of it. And Cena, of course, there's no end in sight. And So Tony Garea is furious. Catering's over. He looked back and saw Christopher having dinner with Vince and Stephanie. I go over and sit down, and I'll be goddamn if Pat Patterson doesn't come up and offer me a Papa John's pizza. I said, well, don't you want it? He says, no, we've had plenty here. You keep it for you guys. So Pat Patterson hands me his pizza, and I think Ivory was there. You remember Ivory?
Sure.
Yes. Yeah.
And she was sweet as she could be. I loved her. And then all of a sudden, Garea comes over, and he says, well, he says, so you mooshed a pizza off Pat? I said, no, I didn't moosh a pizza off Pat. Pat come over here and offered it to me. And I said, I've already had catering. I'm not hungry right now, so whoever wants it can have it. I said, well, you want some pizza, Tony? And he says, you're just a little fucking smartass, aren't you? I looked at him. I said, not tonight, no. I said, Tony, what's the problem? He says, who the fuck do you think you are? He says, you do realize this is a place of work, don't you? I looked at him. I said, yep, that's kind of what I'm here to do. Why is your son here? I said, well, because Jimmy Cornette and Danny Davis said I could bring him. Yeah, he says, well, you should have never put them in that position. This is a place of work. He says, do you know how many times my children have met Vince McMahon? I said, no. Do you know how many times my children have eaten with Vince McMahon? I said, no. He said, it's called never. They have never eaten with Vince. But I look back there, and there's your son, which I basically barely even know who you are. I just know that you're friends with Jimmy. And your son is eating with Vince and Stephanie. I said, yeah, he's a pretty lucky kid, isn't he? So now he's irking me. And I said, yeah, he's a pretty lucky kid. I said, I've never got to eat with Vince either. He says, yeah, once again, he's just being a smart ass. He said, I'm just telling you, you treat this place like a profession. You don't bring your kids to work. I said, well, I said, I love my son, and he goes where I go. What you do with your kids is your business. You want your kid to have dinner with Vince, you might want to talk to Vince about it. I said,
You may want to bring your kids.
I said, Vince invited my son to sit down with him. I didn't go over and impose on him. I said, so if you got a problem with Vince and my son, I advise you probably talk to Vince. I said, because I don't know what your problem is with me, but I ain't done shit to you. And I said, now I'm going to go do my match. And if there's any more problems with me, you certainly let me know. So he hated me from that fucking day on. And then he saw me at a show in Rupp Arena a little later, and he saw that I was there with the state athletic commissioner. Well, Triple H bared his ass to the crowd in that show. Well, that's a no-no in the state of Kentucky. So the athletic commissioner gets up out of his seat, which everybody knows I'm there as his guest. Commissioner goes backstage, starts reaming people out, and says, hey, one more act like that, and I'll shut this show down. He says, who the hell, you can't do that. You know you can't bleed, and you know you can't show any type of any nudity. Well, Triple H realizes that I'm sitting with the state athletic commissioner. They go back and tell Gurria. Gurria has security come out and try to throw me out of the building. They want me out because I'm there with the commissioner. Needless to say, they can't throw the commissioner out. So they take me back, and do you remember the one, the security guy named Dodds or Dodson or whatever his name? He died here a while back.
Yeah.
He was one of them. He was one of the well-known security guys. Well, he was back there. Well, he was back there too, and he says, "Why are you here tonight?" I said, "I was sitting here with Cornette with the state athletic commissioner." Oh, you know Jimmy Cornette? Yeah, you're sticking to that story. I said, "Well, yeah." I said, "We do OVW. Jimmy sent me here tonight and asked me to come here with the state athletic commissioner." I said, he drove. I'm here with him. And Jack something or another was his name. I'm blanking out on his last name. He says, well, we would like for you to leave the building. He says, the commissioner tried to shut this show down, and if you're a part of it, then I got a problem with you. I looked at him. I said, they're really going to fucking try to throw me out because I'm here with the state athletic commissioner. So Dodds or Dodson, whatever his name was, he come over. He says, man, I know you. I know who you are. And I know you're cool. And I know Jimmy's cool. Just let him fucking calm down a minute. Just go back out to your seat and have a seat. And all his shit will blow over. And I examined him. I said, really? I said, he looks pretty hot. He said, just go back to your seat. So I went back out and told the commissioner. I said, they just tried to fucking throw me out of here because I'm here with you. He said, I'd like to see him try. He says, they're going to throw everyone else out of here when they do because I'll shut this fucking show down. So we never had any more problems out of Gurria or anybody else. And Triple H didn't bear his ass anymore. So those are my stories there. I've dominated enough of your all time. If y'all want to get rid of me, I'll fucking leave.
You're a fantastic guest, Kevin.
If anybody else had anything better to say, they'd have fucking spoke up.
Well, maybe they wouldn't have, but
I might not have let them, so I apologize.
All I wanted to say was that I just got your book in the mail about a week ago.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Just digging into it now, post-holidays.
Did you get it from Amazon?
I did get it through the.
You could have paid $11 more for it and got it from me signed, you know.
That's all right.
That's all right. That's $11 saved.
Would you come up with $11 for your autograph?
Well, I guess it just kind of breaks down that way. I sell them for $25.95 on Facebook and ship them, and here lately Cornette's been signing them too because he's got so much shit in the book, so. We've been selling those for 50.
Hey, Kenny, been buying them. Before we let you go, do you think he's home? Should I try him also?
Fuck, you think Jimmy's going to... Jimmy's been asleep for 2 hours.
All right, I'll leave him a message.
It's 9:45, folks. I guarantee you Jimmy's been asleep for 2 hours. He was here in my room visiting me earlier today. One of the old firemen that used to be a sponsor on our show was here visiting me, too. We told some old wrestling stories for about 2 hours, and at 4:45, Jimmy was fading out in a chair sitting here. He was passing out because he drove all the way from Nashville, and he had to go home and get some rest. No, he's asleep. He's asleep at 7:45, I'll guarantee you.
Well, I'll tell you what. You want to leave him a message with us real quick?
Yeah, let's leave him a message.
All right, hold on. Let's
yeah, his number is 502.
No. Stop. All right, hold on. Hold on.
I got in, though, goddammit. Now you just take 1,000 shots.
Stop. I don't want to have to edit. I don't want to have to edit this show. Stop.
9,999 cracks at it, and you'll figure out his number.
All right, hold on.
If you want to call Jimmy that bad.
Let's see if he's there. Scott, get an impression ready, and I'll start off with something. So let's have some fun here. And, oops, I hit the wrong thing. Let's try this again. Add people. Add a phone number we will not be saying on the air.
I said it.
And press add.
It's okay, we're not on the air.
And if he picks up, tell him to hang up and put his message on.
Nah, he ain't gonna pick up. I got money on that.
Well, I don't know if it's ringing. I don't know what's happening here.
Did you dial the right number? You need me to say
hi, everybody.
Again?
Thanks so much for calling. I'm out enjoying life right now, but if you'll leave your name and number and the reason for your happy call, then as soon as I return, I'll listen to it, shove large steel needles into my eyeballs, and then call you back.
You motherfucker, motherfucker!
Hey, Jim. It's Brian and company. We have a guest from the hospital. Say hello.
Hey, Jimmy, how you doing, cocksucker? It's your old buddy, Kenny Bolin. Remember, I did your show earlier today. Jack, your ratings through the fucking roof. I hear you've been bad-mouthing me down in Nashville. I hear you've been talking to everybody, telling them how many gallons of piss have been pulled out of me the past few days. Well, I don't take too kindly to that. You're divulging my personal medical records with a bunch of marks back in a locker room, and I don't take too kindly to it. So let me tell you something, you little piece of shit. I'm going to come over to your house over there in Middletown. I'll tell everybody where you live. You live in Middletown. I'm going to come over there, go to the big house on the big side of the hill. I'm going to come up there, and I'm going to beat the dog shit out of you. You know why? Because you're a stupid fuck, because I know where you live.
We also have another esteemed guest on the line. Are you there, esteemed guest?
Jim, this is I, the genius full of glory and renown. Please pick up the phone. I want to show you something.
No, don't show him that, Lenny Poffo. And John McAdams here, too.
It's a big hit when I...
And John, say hello to Jim as well.
Hello, Angel. How are you?
And we'll leave you with a collection of audio.
Are you a sissy?
Yo. What's up?
No, I...
Tell him in Mexican just to get out of here.
That's not my desk!
Not my desk!
That's not my desk!
Not my desk!
You are nothing but a bottom of the card jobber.
Well, another interesting episode of the Super Podcast here. I guess that's it, Jim. We hope you are well, and we hope we get you on the line one of these days. But talk to you later.
Hey, Jimmy. I said good day.
And I have just hung up on the answer machine.
Jimmy Cornette.
Of Jim Cornette. Well, Kenny, thank you for this memorable appearance, as they all are.
I know where Jimmy lives. I think it was what popped you about Bucci. You stupid motherfucker, we know where you live. So I figured I'd get it in on Cornette, too. He would know probably where it came from.
Well, Kenny...
That was a fun show. I had a good time, and the people out in the hallway wonder why I've been cussing so much, but...
tell them it's the basketball game, yeah.
They just come by here and close the door on a regular basis anymore. When me and Jimmy and the firemen were here, it got a little loud and boisterous, and... Oh, the doctor comes in and says, Kenny, have you took a bath? I looked at her, I said, why do I look dirty? She just looks at me because she's got no sense of humor at all. And she says, have they cleaned your catheter? I said, oh, yeah. I said, the nurse's aide took care of me a little while ago. Oh, yeah. I said, yeah. And then after that, she cleaned my catheter. Jimmy was fucking blowing snot. And the doctor looked back at me and just stormed out of here. Like, she couldn't get out quick enough. But it was a doctor I hadn't seen yet, and she come in here with a bit of an attitude, and not a sense of humor at all. So basically, I told her I fucked one of the aides and then had her clean my dick.
All right, well, so, a memorable appearance by the star maker, Kenny Bolin. Kenny, this
That was on the air?
This is on the air.
Oh, fuck. Well, I thought that was a private story. My bad.
This is the New Year's Eve special, so on behalf of myself and the listeners of the Super Podcast, we want to wish you and your family a very happy New Year. You may respond if you wish.
Happy New Year.
All right. Thanks, Kenny. We'll talk to you later.
All right,
be well, Kenny.
Y'all have a good one. Be good, guys.
You all too. Right,
thanks.
Bye-bye.
And we get the old school hang up there. Well, we're back. John McAdam and Scott Cornish and me here on the show.
How are you guys?
How you been, John? It feels like forever since I've talked to you.
Hold on, you guys got to
You know who I thought could have made it big out of Memphis that did nothing? Alan West.
Alan West? Wait, hold on 1 second. The kids are here. You guys have to go to bed. You want to say hello to the listeners? You've never been on the air. Do you want to say hello?
Yeah.
You want to say Happy New Year? Yeah.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
And you want to sing anything?
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, they have a song for everybody.
All right.
All right. I'm going to count you guys off. You ready? This is the first time they've agreed to do this. Don't go too loud because the microphone's right here. You'll blow out the listener's eardrums, and then we have to pay to have the eardrums fixed, okay? 1, 2, 3, 4.
I got chains, I got charms, sent to gold. I got bracelets for your arms, sent to gold. Money back guarantee, sent to gold. 5-year warranty, sent to gold. You know you're gonna like it, sent to gold. You know you're gonna like it, sent to gold. You know you're gonna like it, 24 karat sent to gold. Huh.
You guys both get donuts tomorrow. I love you. I love you.
Wow, that was wonderful. Gabby, Olivia, that was fantastic.
They have run away.
Adorable.
We have another guest on standby. We're going to talk amongst ourselves for a minute because we haven't had an opportunity yet. Alan West. That's an interesting pick. Unfortunately, as soon as you said that, I thought of the congressman from Florida.
I thought he at least had a good look. He was decent for a guy who had just kind of started out. I couldn't really think of anyone else. Anyone I looked at that, said, okay, he's got some talent, made it on some level,
Well, who I thought had potential, and it came up recently when I had Jimmy on, and we were talking about the Destroyer, was Mark Reagan, who in 84 wrestled in Mid-South and then went to Memphis. Unfortunately, they put him with Rufus R. Jones, which is just a cruel punishment for a young wrestler trying to make it in the industry. But I thought Mark Reagan, and I know he's not actually like a Memphis wrestler, even though he was there for that brief period of time. I thought he had a lot of potential in 84. Who else did I think?
Reagan's a good pick.
Yeah, I mean, Billy Joe Travis, if he had his head on straight, had all the talent to do something.
With his head on straight, he's not Billy Joe Travis.
Right. That's the issue. That's the issue right
there. Even if he had his head on straight, I think that's a guy who definitely had a ceiling. I could not see him in the WWF or even WCW.
Right. I agree with you. Let's see. Who else? Because, so many of the guys from the 80s in Memphis moved on to other things. Even in the early 80s, Jacques Rougeau was there. He moved on. Terry Taylor was there. He moved on. Coco, Bobby, all the, the young Tennessee wrestlers moved on. It really comes down to you start looking at like just those job guys and those undercard guys like Jerry Bryant, like Keith Eric. You start looking at those cast of characters or that
the unfortunate, characters. The unfortunately named Ken Raper.
Yeah, that's a winning. That's a winning name right there.
they must the situation.
They must have known there was no future in that guy when they named him. Shouldn't we change his name? Nah.
Well, maybe Eric Embry as Booker could have gotten mileage out of that last name. Who knows?
Oh.
It was a gimmick.
Sorry, I was just typing to our next guest who's asking what the hell's going on.
Who's our next guest?
Well, let me try to add him to this call because it went so well the last time. Ed. And now the phone's ringing. Let me get something ready here. It is ringing. It is still ringing. Watch him now not pick up. That would be the ultimate revenge.
Hello.
Yo, yo, yo. What's up? What's up? What's up?
What's up? What's up? What's up? Happy New Year!
Happy New Year, Bobby. You say Happy New Year. I don't have to say season's greetings any longer.
Well, no. But I will say this. Fuck the season greetings, because I'm still a little bit hot, because you know why? That damn Santa Brown didn't even come to my town. I can't believe that. He might have come to my town, but he didn't come to my part of town. But I'll say this, 2017 is going to be my year, your year, and a 605 year. So, no, fuck your season's greetings. Happy New Year!
It's too bad that Santa Brown from out of town didn't swing by your house. It would almost make up for it if we had him on the line right now.
I know that, but I'm going to move
to a different town.
I'm going to move to a different part of town next year. I'm out here in South Ashland. Next year, I'm moving to L.A.
Really?
Yeah, Lower Ashland. Lisa has more. Yeah, I'm going down there. Maybe he'll visit me then, you know?
Well, Bobby, you're joined right now on the line by two esteemed guests of the Super Podcast. One is John McAdam, who has been a guest and a co-host on the show, and the other is the man behind Santa Brown from Out of Town. And of course, that sounds filthier than I intended it to. And that is Scott Cornish.
Gentlemen, Hello. Thank you. Hello, and it's my pleasure.
Bobby, the pleasure's all mine. I'm someone who twice made the trip from New Hampshire down to Smoky Mountain area to see you guys. It was well worth it. How are you, man?
Man, I'm doing pretty good. And thank you for making that trip, and I'm sure it was well worth it because what a hell of a territory that was. And it's my pleasure, seriously. And, hey, thanks, man. That's great. And great. Thank you.
Great to talk to you, Bobby. This is Scott. Yeah, I'll echo,
nice to meet you.
Echo those words. Those were, I've said it before, and I mean it. Those trips down to Tennessee and Kentucky to see those Smoky Mountain shows were the most fun I've ever had as a wrestling fan. And I've been following wrestling for, oh, my God, 40 years maybe.
That's great. Haven't we all?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, at least us that are older, but yeah.
Well, I always tell
good memories for you.
I always tell people that every kid, at least every boy, watches wrestling, and some of them just grow out of it, and then some of us never do. And we're definitely in the group that we caught the bug and it never went away.
I used to get Smoky Mountain Wrestling tapes every 4 weeks from this guy in Tennessee, and they would arrive, and I'm like, okay, I'll watch one show per day for the next 4 days. And, of course, I'd watch all four of them, like, the same night.
Instantly,
yeah. You couldn't put it down. It's like a book you couldn't put down.
Yeah, it's like at what Netflix has now, the binge watching. You know, I'm sure you guys probably, once you've got a tape, back when I would get it, and guys, I love the business from a young age as well. I never was into tape trading until I got into the business, believe it or not. And I'd get stuff in Japan when I was down in Tampa. And, of course, if I was in Smoky Mountain, I'd get tapes. But, like you guys, I'd binge watch it. I'd rewatch it, whether it was our show, other shows, or whatever that I had my hands on. But, yeah, it's one of those things, like you said, I don't know. Once the bug bites you, man, you got it. And I was going to say, and I didn't want to interrupt you, one of you, but like my brother's always told me, and he's a couple years younger, man, he said, man, Bob, wasn't it much better when we were marks? And it is. And I tell you, I don't watch today's product a lot. I will occasionally. I'll turn into pay-per-view or what have you. But bottom line is, you know, I watch a lot of stuff. I was watching the stuff that that was mentioned, Bob, I'm going to draw a blank. Bowden.
Oh, Jeff Bowden
from Japan.
Yeah,
Jeff Bowden. I've been watching that stuff in Japan from like 87 and some of those matches that was caught out the other day on the show, which I love the 605. I don't need to tell you I'm a fan or a friend. But I'm just a fan and a friend to the wrestling business. But wasn't it much better when it was marks? And of course,
definitely.
I'm off on a tangent. If you ask me, I'm not a smark. I don't believe in a fucking term smark. I believe in I love TR or Stuttering Tommy Riches or Tom, whoever, great character here, break the fourth wall. But bottom line is, you know what? Like he said, when Bobby Ford said, well, I'm a mark, you're a mark, we're all marks, you know. I spoke to Kevin Sullivan, you know, several times, and that's not bragging and boasting. That's just someone I happen to have a good professional and personal relationship with. You know what it is? He said, Bobby, we're all fans. I'm still a fan. And it's much better when you're a fan of professional wrestling. And, man, those were the times where you'd like, again, to go around the world to cross the street, wind my watch to say, hey, man, it's much better when we were all just fans of the professional wrestling business. But thank you all very much. And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. You know, I would what I would give to go back and have the mindset that my friends and I used to have when we'd be in a car going to the wrestling matches, debating on who would win the match between Frank Williams and Frank the Gypsy Rodriguez. And we cared about that. Who was going to win this match?
Yeah. That's great.
Well, the Smoky Mountain for me, and maybe for the world at large, was the last territory the last gasp of sort of the territories, and Memphis hung around there longer. But you would go down there and you would see crowds that just simply believed. They liked the good guys, they didn't like the bad, they booed the bad guys, and they believed what they were seeing. And 500 people in a high school gym down there made more noise than shows that I've seen at Madison Square Garden. And and sometimes people would look at you like you're stupid or incredulous and say, they really believe that stuff down there? They must be dumb. And I said, it's not dumb. It's amazing. It was exhilarating to be in that environment and to see what they call heat. God knows I never saw it watching WWF shows in the 90s up here, you know. Just a bunch of nonsense.
Thanks for sharing that. That's the thing. Smoky Mountain, that was probably, to me, again, it's probably one of the, if not the last, quote, territory. And what a privilege to work there and be a part of that, you know, organization and company. But the bottom line is the people believed it. There was just something special about it. And again, it's not a reflection of Appalachian or ignorance or hillbillies or what have you. It's just that the programming and the storylines, they weren't necessarily programming the storylines. They were bookings. They were guys that were booked against each other. And thank God Jim Cornette, had the foresight to still try, you know, as his baby. And of course, I'm always put over Jim Cornette. I'm a Jim Cornette guy. But he was trying to do something there. It was his baby, like I said. And the fans in this area, I know, you could say, and I'm not going to try and insult anyone's intelligence. You could say, a bunch of fucking hillbillies or rednecks or inbreds or whatever. But, you know, the bottom line is people bought into it because at that point it was still believable. It wasn't the stuff you were seeing on it's not a knock towards any company. WWF at the time, and I remember us outdrawing WCW in Knoxville at the Civic Coliseum before they even went to the Nitro shows. They were sending out 10,000 tickets, and we outdrew them at the Knoxville Civic Coliseum because people believed in our product. And it had nothing to do with intelligence or ignorance. It had to do with wrestling education. Our fans were educated down here in a way that they believed in the in-ring product, the promotion, the promos, the guys that work there. And, so it's kind of like, you know, the last great territory, if you will. And I don't know. I'm more defender, of course, but I don't need to if you guys, because you all, you know, came, saw, lived, seen it as well as I did. And, that's not towards anyone, and I appreciate those kind words towards FMW. But the bottom line is, the fans believe because you know why? It was still believable.
Sure.
And not only that, there's a certain, I don't know, mindset that the wrestling fan has. Back in 1985, I went to see Rocky IV. It was the one Rocky against the Russian. And Rocky got in the first shot against the Russian guy, and the movie theater popped. And this is right outside of Boston. So it's just a question of, hey, you know, just turn your brain on or off or do whatever you have to do and just get into it.
Yeah.
No, at its best, It can still take you to that place. I saw a show in Knoxville, real bloody match in the ring. It was a tag team match, and at one point, I think it's Dirty White Boy is pounding Tom Pritchard's head into a table, and he does it maybe 30 times. And Tom is getting bloodier and bloodier, and he's getting his head bashed into that table 30 times. And at some point, I'm sitting there going, stop, my God, please stop. That poor man.
You know, it was the same thing the year before at the Night of Legends when, you know, I don't know about you, John, or you, Scott, but for me, it was the first time I saw the Thrill Seekers, Lance Storm and Chris Jericho. And I had been hearing about them and reading about them in The Observer, but I never saw them before then. They're going against the Heavenly Bodies. So it's the first time I've ever seen them. And Jericho hits a gusher. And it's one of the bloodiest matches ever, to the point where Hildebrand was covered in blood. You know, his little white shirt with the suspenders, just blood everywhere. And I remember thinking, like, they have to stop this match. That poor guy.
I was the same way.
Yeah, yes, same thing.
I was the same way. I'm like, they have to stop this match for real, whether or not, you know, it's supposed to be. They can't keep doing this.
Yeah. And having been in a match one of the last matches where I dropped one of the titles, which was the heavyweight title, to Landell. Of course, my gimmick, as you all know, and or may not know, to the fans, you know, I was no quit kid, you know, blah, blah, blah. But when I finally get the title, drop the title, whatever, Landell just, bam, he's whamming on me. And one of the few times that I got the juice there, and Mark Curtis, you know, Hildebrand, he steps in and stops it. And that was the thing, was I wasn't going to quit. He had to stop the fight. But the believability was there. That Buddy was just bashing my head in so fucking bad. You know, and I had blood on me. Brian had blood on him. And people still believed enough. Like you said about Tommy, like enough, but you still kept on, you know, stop the match. And that's what happened in my match to drop the title back was, you know, Brian finally just threw it out. This guy's not quitting. I kept getting up and bam, I'd go back down. And I'm not trying to get myself over. I'm getting a fucking promotion over and a believability over because I believed in what I was doing. And before I went to the ring knowing, you know, what was going to come up, you know, I knew approximately when I was going to drop it, to who and when, give or take a couple of weeks, to be honest with you. But when it did come up, you know, I myself wanted to believe that as well. So therefore, as a fan, I wanted the fans to believe that, you know, fuck, I'm not quitting. I'm not giving up. I'm not tapping out. I am getting beat to the point of, to a pulp, to the point of I can no longer continue. That, bless his heart, rest in peace, poor Mark Curtis was going to have to stop this fight or Buddy Landell was going to kill me. You know, that's the believability of a territory. And even then, after dropping, and I, behind the scenes stuff, I had talked to, you know, Corny, with all due respect of like, if I do this, you know, you're going to bring someone, you know, what's next for me? Am I just, you know, I didn't want to just like, that's my living. I had, you know, I loved it and I loved being there. The morale in the locker room was great. I loved the territory, blah, blah, blah. I didn't want to just be like, okay, you drop the title, you're done. So he was like, no, Bobby, I'm bringing other guys to work with you. You're still here, blah, blah, blah. So that was a good point. But my point was I want to stay strong enough that when you work in territories, everyone has to stay strong. So if Buddy beat me to a pulp and I'm bleeding to where Brian or Mark Hildebrand has to stop the match, that people still want to come back and see me against whoever it is next week or 2 weeks down the line. And they also want to see Buddy defend the title, you know, in a couple of weeks. It's all about the territory, you know, believability. Yeah. So I didn't want to be beat so bad, even though I was beaten to where I couldn't continue, that I'd A, quit, or B, I got pinned, or whatever you want to call it, you know. And I understood that. Jimmy understood that. Buddy understood that. And, of course, Brian understood that. And that's the whole thing, because it was that believability. And for a while, you know, you take people out of the realm of, like you mentioned earlier, going to a movie. It takes people out of, for a couple of years, it's that suspended belief, man, of, hey, holy shit, this guy can't continue anymore. And you mentioned Tom, you're like, please stop the match. You know, his head's been bashed into that table so many times. You're like, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? Stop it. Can it go on or what have you? That, but didn't, Tom didn't lose anything over that. He didn't lose any heat. You know, he comes back. You see my point. I know I'm preaching to the choir.
Oh, yeah,
but the bottom line is I wanted, and I think Jimmy did, and the Smoky Mountain Territory did, they wanted the believability because it was there.
Oh, yeah.
One of my favorite matches I've ever seen from Smoky Mountain or really anywhere, and I bet all four of us have seen this match. I know Brian and Scott have because they were there. The Shawn Michaels versus Buddy Landell match from Smoky from the Night of Legends.
Super Bowl Wrestling.
Super Bowl Wrestling. It was a
Super Bowl Wrestling
in August of 95.
Not to correct anyone. I won't overstep anyone, disrespect anyone. Super Bowl Wrestling, Landell and Michaels, though, in Knoxville, correct?
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. It was almost that's as good one. As Bobby Blaze versus Dan Severn. No, I'm kidding.
But it was great because Sean was the baby face from out of town.
50s, dude. At least the second time I worked with Severn is about 50-50 instead of fucking 80-20 with me just trying to get the fuck away from that guy. but no, not to put myself over. Honestly, you know, first time I wrestled Dan, you know, hey, was in Charlotte, it was like 80-20. And at least in Knoxville, it was like 50-50. But to go back to that show, it was Super Bowl and of wrestling, and Landell and Shawn Michaels, what a fucking match. And, and I put up my book, and I'm not here to pump books. I'm here to tell you guys, hey, happy fucking New Year. All you 605 fans, bless your heart. Thank you. Brian, thank you. All you guys. And what a pleasure to meet new people and talk to new people throughout the entire 605 Super Podcast universe as a fan, as a friend, as a performer, what have you. But shit, man. When Buddy was on, and him and fucking Shawn Michaels went out there that night and tore the fucking house down in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Yeah.
It was great because the crowd was split. Like, half of the crowd was for Shawn, you know, the baby face from out of town, and half of them were for the local guy who was in the middle of a baby face turn. So to me, it made like a boxing match where it was like 50-50 with the crowd.
He just did that promo on TV. There was the go home show before the Super Bowl where it's him and you know General Jim Cornette, because every disciple of Jerry Lawler has to be a general at some point in their career. You know, Eddie Gilbert did that, and Cornette had to do that, and they're doing their typical.
Wonder where he's got that idea at.
Yeah, I have no idea. They're doing the promo, and you know he goes, and I'm going to be there to help Buddy however I have to, and Buddy goes, no, you won't, and it was just that right there was the subtle turn. And then Buddy turns to the camera, and it's a remarkable interview where he goes, you know, because, you know, the average person at home knows nothing about any of this. We knew about it because we were reading newsletters, and, you know, he was no-show Budrow. I mean, we knew about his issues behind the scenes. We knew about the opportunities.
Great recall. Great recall, that name, yes.
Yeah, and we knew about the opportunities he had blown. And when all of a sudden he turns to the rank and file, the average person sitting at home in Knoxville watching Beulah in the front row and everyone else, and says, I have had a problem with drinking and drugs, and I have blown all these opportunities, and this is my big shot, and I'm not from Hollywood, I'm from Knoxville, and I'm going to do this. I mean, that's a remarkable interview.
I just watched that recently, too. Another podcast is up to date on some different things on, you know, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, I watched that promo, and I watched a lot of YouTube, and I watched a lot of old stuff. Like, so I went back to all those Japanese matches. I went back to a couple of the girls' matches, as mentioned, the last podcast, the Hall of Day one. And I'll hear stuff, and I'll say, oh, God, I watch this match if I hadn't already seen it. But, you know, when Buddy done that, and I think it's like a high school locker room, it looks like. I can't recall where we were at when he done it. It could have been, you know, wherever. But it was actually a shoot interview. But he is sitting there telling you, you know, no, you won't help me, Jimmy. You know, hey, here's the deal. And he's just being Buddy. And he's telling him, this is going to be, for years I went around And I said, I'm from Hollywood, different places. I'm from right here in Locksville, and I'm going to do this. And I'm not going to try to emulate Buddy in any way. But that interview, it got over so well because it was so real and it was believable. To be redundant, it was exactly what you said. He said, you know, the fact that it was almost like breaking the fourth wall. He didn't talk about being, he didn't talk about the used cars. He didn't talk about, he wasn't trying to sell you something. What he was trying to tell you was, listen, I'm Buddy Landell and I've got a chance to wrestle Shawn Michaels and the Super Bowl of wrestling. And he just went out there and delivered a heartfelt and a straight 99.9% shoot interview or a promo. It just got over so well, man. And people believed he actually had a chance. That was a thing.
That's and then the match. Watch.
Yeah. And then the match, they, you know, hey, there was a lot of good matches on that card. You know, if you go back and view that video or that tape or what have you, DVD now, I guess. But from top to bottom, it was loaded from, you know, guys from USWA, Smoky Mountain, some independents, WWE and WCW. It was loaded and independents. And of course, I worked several on that one. And I won't say I worked him. But yeah, I did. You know what? I did work him because the first time was about a fucking 80-20 shoot, like I said. But the, you know, the thing about that show that I recall, when I walked back through the curtain after a match, when I say I worked several, I'm getting to a point of, he actually came to my hometown and stayed on night the night before. We went to the gym together and worked out. I'm assuming most of you people in a 605 are at least somewhat smart. And I said, listen, I've been in this area for 3 years. I've been a TV champ, junior heavyweight champ, and heavyweight champ. You can't just eat me up. The last time we worked, you had 3 matches. And we went to a gym, we worked out, and I said, look, let me at least counter. I know you can fucking, I'm not saying you can stretch me, which you probably could, but I'm a man. I have some self-respect. I said, you can beat my ass in 3 fucking seconds if you want, but I said, at least let me counter. Give me a chance to counter when you do something to me and hold the move or the hold for a second or two before you just fucking are anticipating what the guy's going to do and the fans will believe in it. And anyway, my point is of that, it became a 50-50 gentleman's agreement. Otherwise, it would, you know, we're not in a fucking cage, but otherwise it wouldn't have lasted 30 seconds, and there's no entertainment value in that at that point when you're doing a professional wrestling show. But I digress on that. But when that match happened, even though Buddy Landell later in the show, and Cornette had a lot of responsibilities, I mean, he was promoting, booking, managing the whole, you know, top to bottom of the show. When I walked back through that curtain, Buddy Landell stood up and said, Bobby, you got to send that. He had been watching it on a monitor in the back. And he said, Bobby, you got to send that match to Japan. That was a hell of a match, buddy. He shook my hand, gave me a hug. And Jimmy said, thank you. And of course, Buddy still had to go out there later on. So in the middle of thinking about what do I have to do with, and I speak for Buddy, and in the middle of thinking, oh, man, I'm going on later on in my hometown to work Shawn Michaels, a WWE, I guess it's still F at that time, show combination or star, rather, with a combination of all these great promotions come together. Buddy took the time to tell me, send that to Japan, and what a great match you had. And Jimmy thanked me, of course, and all that. But, you know, that's just professionalism. And then Buddy went out there and fucking tore the house down with Shawn Michaels. And, yeah, I was there for every match. I'm one of them guys that I stayed that night for every fucking match because from top to bottom, opening to the main, every match was a lot of shows or a lot of matches get these things nowadays. Five-star. Well, I just tweeted something to Cornette the other day about his 5-star rating system with the dually guy, the TV guy, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So, you know, I understand that, and you can go back to Meltzer with his ratings and those type things. People put over, oh, is this five-star? You know what? There's not a lot of five-star matches. And so I'm not saying that, you know, I went out there and had one or Buddy did or Sean did or whatever. But when you go back and you look at that and you think about what they were, what we were all doing at that time, we were trying to obtain a five-star match and perform to the best of our abilities that the fans would love and appreciate that, you know what, these guys just gave their best. And, you know, that's the whole deal, man. Smoky Mountain was still, at that point, a territory, and people from the back to the fan were still anticipating every match had the possibility of being, and again, not that all of them were, but we were at least trying to give the fans a five-star match. Whether it was or wasn't, didn't matter. We were trying our best. And then we're out in that locker room. Here it is. Buddy and I had personal, professional heat. We worked together. We loved each other. We cared for each other. We could piss on each other. It didn't matter. But we hit that ring. We were going to deliver the best match we could possibly deliver. And that night, I delivered the best match I could with Dan Severn, and he delivered the best match he could deliver with Shawn Michaels. And it put together, and I'm sure Al Snow with Marty Jannetty and the Rock and Roll and the PG-13 and the Gangster and all the guys on that whole show, everyone tried to give back to a business that we all love.
You mentioned sure, the Rock and Roll. Do. The Rock and Roll weren't on that show because the show happened shortly after the incident in a car with Ricky Morton and Andrea Morton.
Ricky got fired because him and Andrea got a fight with Tracy and some fucking stripper, I know, but you know what I'm getting at. I'm sorry. Yeah, you're right, Mr. Fucking Historian. Call me out on a fucking national and international fucking internet radio podcast.
I wasn't meaning to call you out. I wanted to ask you.
Okay, you're right. You're right, Howard Stern. Okay. Damn.
Well, what I wanted to ask you.
My point being, yes, I was there. I know. They fucking got in a fucking cat fight in a car because Ricky's defending his girl and Tracy's defending some fucking slut and blah, blah, blah. Okay. Whatever. Bottom line is PG-13 was there from over in USWA and part of the Rock and Roll Express was still there. Tracy was still there. And okay, how far are we going to break fucking kayfabe? God damn it, Brian.
God damn it. Listen, Bobby, what I wanted to ask you before you went on your little rant was, do you remember where you were when you heard about the whole car incident between Tracy Smothers and his girlfriend and Ricky Morton and his then girlfriend?
I don't remember the town. I remember being at a building and that Ricky was no longer there. And Tracy was like, he was already going like, Tracy was saying stuff like, if I recall correctly, which I probably won't, so I'll just make up something. No, as you know, I'm a straight shooter. Not in a shooter type way, but in a straight shoot. I recall Ricky had been released because of the incident because it made some local news and some local newspapers, et cetera. I was in a building, and it was like, Ricky's not going to be here. And it was all these things. And Tracy was already saying, fuck, he was all over some fucking stupid bitch I picked up kind of thing. And her and Andrea got into it. Me and Ricky got into it. And it was just, it was a clusterfuck of about 3 or 4 days. And the best thing that could have happened. And my memory was, with all due respect to Ricky, all due to Tracy, and I know Andrew very good, I met the other fucking douchebag that was involved, that was a fucking stripper, cunt, whore, whatever you want to call her. She just thought she could just waltz right in and be part of the business and one of the boys' girls or whatever. And I'm sure Tracy fucked her before then, after then, and many more since then, that he could care less what I say about it. But the bottom line is, you could just see the writing on the wall. When that girl showed up in the territory, she was nothing but a fucking, and I'm going to go ahead, if there's any female listeners out there, I know a lot of them hate this word, but
we're children.
I'm not, we're children. I'm sorry. But guys don't mind it, but girls do. But that bitch was a fucking cunt. But Andrea, to me, I met Andrea for a long time. I knew Andrea for a long time. I knew Ricky for a long time. Knew Trace for a long time. And basically, you know, she was the fucking cunt of the situation. And as soon as it happened, within a few weeks, you know, Tracy was like, oh, shit, man. He felt bad about it. And I know he did. And they all worked out. And Ricky and Andrea, and I think the world of Andrea. I know what she did prior to getting into business. And, you know, she was even in the Aerosmith video at one point. And I love them all, and I care for them all. But, you know, that girl, I probably saw her for probably 2 or 3 weeks, and I could see right through her then. And she's a fucking cunt, and she's a fucking troublemaker because she thought, oh, I'm part of pro wrestling. I'm baiting, you know, Tracy Smothers. I'm this and that. And you know, I don't like to say these. If I can't say anything good about you, I don't like saying things bad about you. But I don't know that girl's name because they, I don't give a fuck what her name was, but you could just tell that she was a fucking cunt and a troublemaker, and it caused problems. And, you know, since then, of course, years went by, but I'm talking within a few weeks. Of course, Jimmy couldn't hire Ricky back right away because of the mainstream media. I won't say mainstream. Let's just say regional media coverage that it got. But yeah, I was in a building at a place and heard about it. And I was like, oh shit, man, I hate to hear that. And I think by the time I heard it, Tracy's like already feeling bad about it because he knew too. We're the boys. We know. You know when someone's fucking a worker, trying to work a fucking worker. You can't fucking work a worker.
Well, first thing is I can't repeat it because the kids, I think, are still awake, but that that B is a C is a all-time classic quote here on the show. That's the first thing.
Well, can they hear me?
No, thankfully.
Can your kids?
No.
Okay,
no.
Well, that bitch was a fucking cunt.
There you go. And what I remember being there, and I'm sure John and Scott may remember this, was, you know, one of the cool things about going down for Fan Week wasn't just attending all the shows and being around the wrestlers and getting to know Cornette, but you also got to watch Smoky Mountain TV on its actual television station when it aired, as opposed to waiting for a tape. And, you know, us tape collectors, we invented binge watching. You know, it started with us. And I remember seeing the Smoky Mountain show that weekend, you know, August of 95. And one of the commercials was Ricky and Andrea Morton for, I think, Terry Landell. They were already working for his Outlaw shows, you know, a mere couple of weeks after the incident.
Well, as independent contractor, Ricky had to get some fucking money, so he went right to work, you know. But I'm surprised. Was that around the time Cornette, you know, chased Terry Lindell across the fucking thing with the miniature golf course with the golf club, you know?
No, that was after.
I know way after. I'm just throwing a reference out there. But so, yeah, you got to understand, and I'm sure you guys do, that, yeah, within a week, is that what you said? So here's Ricky and Andrea appearing on fucking another crosstown quote promotion with Terry Landell. I'm going to be, you know, whatever. Yeah. But yeah, because guys got to make a living. You're out of fucking job. It's like if you work for, oh, I'll go old school. If you work for fucking Procter & Gamble or you work for fucking Gillette or wherever, if you fucking get laid off and fucking making razors or you're selling toothpaste or toasters or whatever, and you get laid off, you got to go across town to work for another company or, you know, and make money. You got a family to feed. So,
but
if you're in the steel industry, you go across town to work for the other steel company, you know, whatever it is, whether it be, you know, razors, toasters, or steel, or wrestling. You get laid off, or you get fired. You go across and try to get another fucking job. But fuck, you know, here, like you said, Ricky, within a week or two, is working for Terry Lindell. And I know it was later on when Jimmy chased him with the miniature golf club. But the point is, you got to, as one of the boys, we're independent contractors. And Ricky had to go and get a payday, whereas Tracy still in his defense, still had a job with Smoky Mountain. So, you know, you show up where you're booked or where you book yourself or what have you.
But for Terry Landell to take that guy after 2 weeks, I don't even blame Ricky, but for Terry Landell to then put that commercial, pay to put that commercial on Jim's TV. He wonders why he gets chased by a golf cart.
Yeah, well, I've met Terry Landell a few times, and since my very first meeting until now, I've never worked for the guy. And if he called me tomorrow and said, you know, Bobby, would you come for a book signing? Would you come for a booking for, I know which I'm a few hours from Knoxville, but would you consider coming in for me or whatever? Here's the thing, man. No, Terry, and I know he probably, if he does listen to this, Terry Landell, fuck you, Terry Landell. But anyway, if he did call me, I'd still tell him, you know what, if you want me to come down for a book signing, send me not just half, but all my money and a booking fee in advance in cash. And fuck you then, and I still probably not show up for him. And I know a lot of guys that know him, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful. I'm just being honest. I'd say, you know what? I'd send him 2 books and say, fucking, here's my autograph on them. Sell them yourself, motherfucker, and fuck yourself, because I'm a Jim Cornette guy and I'm a Smoky Mountain wrestling guy. And the many times that I've spoken to him, probably which has been many, meaning, excuse me, fucking pizza, fucking beer, pepperoni, burp there. I'd still say, fuck you, fuck your book signing. If you don't send me some fucking money, fuck you and the horse you rode in on. I don't care how well you're doing. I don't care how you're not doing. Fuck you. And it's just like with the 605, all these people that are, you know, supporting. And Brian, I will be in touch soon at the first year to do some Amazon business through the tiny URL or URL or whatever the fuck you call that to make
what it is,
a little bit of a contribution. Say it, please promote it. Say it.
The new link as of 2017, tinyurl.com/superpod Amazon.
And I'm going to be using that. So you people fucking use that, because I'm going to, because I support this show. I'm a fan and a friend, as I told you. But, you know, and I don't want to badmouth anyone, but you know what, Terry Landell, fuck you and fuck the horse you rode in on. And I don't care who you're associated with, but you know what? You're not getting me to come down there for any amount of money, because I don't need your fucking money, because you're not going to fucking pay me anyway, because you know why? I'm a Cornette guy. There you go.
There you go.
Well, there you go. And with that, Bobby, another memorable appearance here on the Super Podcast Holiday Spectacular.
Well, hey, Scott Corner's clapping. It's been my pleasure.
Well, listen.
Scott, thank you for the applause. you know, Brian, can I say one thing?
Yeah, say it.
You didn't ask me, but you was talking about Christmas show memories, and I started off by saying, you know, Santa Brown didn't even come to my part of town. What a fucking letdown. But you know what? I'm an adult. I can handle that. But I don't have... I could only say, probably through memories of, I have a couple personal special dates that I worked on Christmas that stand out in my mind. But for all you people out there, Thanksgiving shows are the gateway drug to Christmas shows. Okay. And it's kind of like they say marijuana, the gateway drug to other harder drugs. My only memories are of Thanksgiving shows, because by the time, if it's a gateway drug, by the time the Christmas shows rolled around, I was already too addicted and too already messed up to remember the Christmas shows, because those were even harder to recall. But I have a lot of great memories from my youth, as a fan perspective, to one of the boys to realize that, hey, from Thanksgiving to Christmas, what great shows I recall through memory, not drugs, that pro wrestling brought to me. And again, here's a cheap ass book plug. I put this in all my books when I autograph them. All we recall or all we remember the great memories that pro wrestling has brought to your life and life's best to you, because I have those memories as well as a fan, as one of the boys, as a performer or whatever. And I have to say thank you to Brian, to the 605. Thank you, gentlemen, for being on here listening to me. But seriously, when I sign something, I put two things on everything, book-wise, that I sign. And that is this: always remember the good matches, or always remember, if not both, if I put them on there, the good times that pro wrestling or professional wrestling has brought into your life and life's best to you. And then I sign it. And I mean that most sincerely to whether you're a 605 fan and you guys are on the show with me tonight and to myself, I remind myself, man, wasn't it much better and much better when we were all marks? And there's nothing wrong with that, because deep down, we're all just fans. So with that said, Happy New Year. Thank you, 605. Thank you guys very much. And always remember or always recall the great memories that pro wrestling brought to your life and life's best to you. And that's Bobby Blaze or Bobby Blaze Medley. And I appreciate your fans, I appreciate your friendships, I appreciate the support, and all these celebrity deaths and all these fucking people that talk about how bad 2016 was. May 2017 be your best year, and furthermore, all your years ahead of you, and may we all share many, many, many more great memories from professional wrestling. And I hope there's a whole lot more in store for all of us, because I'm a fan, I'm one of the boys, and I'm a friend and a supporter of the show for the great 605 Super Podcast. And thank you very much.
Well, that's very, very nice.
Wonderful.
Bobby. And I appreciate that. And I return the compliments. Happy New Year to you. And we'll be talking to you shortly here on the show.
Thank you, Bobby. Yes,
thank you.
Pleasure
thank
making you, your acquaintance, guys, Bobby.
My pleasure. Thank you, guys.
Well, there we go. Another memorable appearance here on the show by Bobby Blaze. A subdued Bobby Blaze, other than the, you know, that B was a C and everything else he said. But I know you are short on time tonight, Scott, and me and John are going to continue on here in a little bit. But let's, before you leave the show, let's talk a little bit. You know, we've all talked about the fact we were Fan Week. When did you first meet John?
I guess I would have met him at the second Fan Week. I don't know if we ever corresponded before that. One of those names that are.
So.
No, I don't. I didn't buy tapes from you.
Thanks.
So. I do remember a get together in your room, which was like everybody in that room was like a newsletter writer or put out their own newsletter. It was like a mini
newsletter weasel is what you're trying to say.
But it was a mini convention. It was you and I think Lennis started people from Atlanta. Doug McKay was in there. It was just a whole crazy assemblage of all these Harry, you know, people that knew Harry for a year or so before that. But yeah, it would have been the second year at Fan Week. I told Brian the other day I had a room between you and Brian. Our rooms were right in a row there. Young Brian last, old Scott Cornish, and slightly younger John McAdam.
Much younger, believe me. It's very, you know, it's too bad that you were as young as you were, because I think if you were 10 years older, I'm sure you had fun. You would have had a whole lot more fun.
I had a ton of fun the second year, because by the time I was 15, I had punched out that putz. I kind of had, I had credibility. I had a good reputation. People knew that I was friends with some people already from the year before, like Tracy Smothers and Jim Cornette. And also I had the tape collection. By that, between 14 and 15, my tape collection had grown exponentially. and I brought my VCR down and I hosted tape parties. So when I was 15, I felt like I was in, like, no problem. But the year before, I didn't know anybody. I was the youngest person there on my own by far. I remember there was one kid younger, like, with his dad for, like, half the trip. I don't even know who the hell that kid was. But I was the youngest one there by far, and I didn't know anybody. And, you know, now that I'm 37, I look back and I think of, like, all you guys, and, you know, you all seem relatively young, but at the time, you all seemed so old. And, you know, yeah. I remember Scott Dickinson was there. He looked like he was, like, 70 in my eyes. And, you know, but I remember, like, I think, you know, I don't remember which one of you guys would have been there. I'm guessing it may have been you, John, and maybe like Jeff Siegel and a few other people. But I remember, like, the first night at the Old Town Inn or the West Town Inn. I forget exactly what the hotel was. There was like a bunch of people out by the pool hanging out and talking. And I just remember being like, I can't go out there. I don't know who any of these people are. I'm just going to be like wandering over their shoulder, trying to wait to get drawn into a conversation. And it didn't really. So I kept to myself for the most part early on in the trip. And then I had my mojo going the next year.
That's good, man. I mean, I can imagine being 14 years old and surrounded by a bunch of adults. And, you know, I wouldn't know what to do.
Yeah. I mean, that's what it was. I didn't know, you know, I didn't know any of these people. And I recognized that everyone just saw me as being some kid. No one thought like, oh, that kid is, you know, he knows what he's talking about, or he's street smart, or he's tough, or whatever. Like, they just saw me as being some kid. I was the youngest. I was the smallest. Not that I was small. I wasn't tiny, but I was very, very, very skinny. I wish I was that skinny today when I look back at pictures of that. But yeah, that's what it was. And the next year, you know, it all kind of clicked. I mean, the moment that always resonates with me is the moment where I felt like I'm accepted was when Harry White started talking to me. That
there
was
you go.
Where I was like, I'm in, I'm good. And
I sitting right in front of you on the bus one time?
You could have been. I don't remember.
I have a vague memory of this. Yeah. Now I'm starting to remember you from the trip.
You may have been. You may have been.
Or I could just be full of shit. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I remember the Johnson City Death Bus trip, the best of all those bus trips. That year, and what a disaster that was. And then we get to the show in Johnson City, and my lasting memory of that show is, oh, who worked with Bob Orton? Someone was working with Bob Orton. Maybe it was like Tony Anthony. And it started with, I think, the Philly fans, who, you know, were always about trying to get themselves over by chanting. Even back then, that was like their thing. And they started chanting, "We want Piper, we want Piper," and "Tag in Piper." And then it went back to "We want Piper." And at one point, Bob Orton turns around and goes, "So do I." And, you know, that killed it. That was enough. The recognition was enough to get everyone to stop chanting in the smart section, the smart fan section of the audience there.
Well, I remember in the audience during Orton's match, that this just tickled me. There was a young mother there with her daughter, and her daughter was really, really young. And they're watching the matches, and Orton's out there. And she says, "Honey, that guy used to be managed by Izzy Slapowitz."
No.
I swear.
Get out of here.
I said, teach them when they're young. You know, you got to teach them those essential mysteries of life.
Well, I guess the thing that's amazing about that isn't that she would remember that or know that. It's that she would say it to her child in a way.
Yeah, like everyone would know that name.
Yeah, like everybody, like, oh, Izzy managed him? Like, yeah. That's amazing.
Oh, it would be great if the girl came back with, "Was he in the Devil's Duo?" No. I promise you, I heard that. That was so funny. Yeah.
What was your best memory of Fan Week, John? That first year, 94. The first year for us, not the first year of Fan Week.
I would say me and Brian Hildebrand. No, okay, here it is. We're near the pool, and Bob Armstrong is sitting by the pool. And I just walked up to him, and I said hi. I said, you know, the first time I ever saw you, you were wrestling a gentleman named Sterling Golden. This was on cable TV. He brightened right up. And so me and a couple of my friends start talking to him, and we're getting into the War of 74, right? Just starting to do this.
Oh, wow.
And a bunch of the goddamn Philly guys, "Oh, Bob Armstrong, look at this, what a conversation this must be." And Bob ran for his life.
So I kind of felt in hearing that story like I missed a lot not going out to the pool that first day. But then again, I didn't miss anything not going out to the pool.
And it was me and it was Jeff Siegel and I'm trying to remember who else. But we were all like, you know, thanks for screwing everything up, you bunch of assholes. Jesus, you know.
I mean, that's what's kind of...
It was me, Steve Walsh, and Jeff Siegel. And we were just about to pry this guy for some good information, and boom.
Yeah. Who's Steve Scott Walsh? I don't remember who Steve Walsh is.
He's not around anywhere anymore, but he used to be one of my... He was one of my buddies I ran around with for Fan Week, both of them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, I don't remember him.
Scott Dickinson was with you guys that year.
Yes, he was. I have a picture of the four of us, like, goofing around, so I'll put it on Facebook or something.
Yeah, you guys were the guys who were too cool to sit in the front row with everyone at the television taping, and you sat in the bleachers. I remember.
That's where we are in the bleachers in this picture. Yeah, I have always been very cliquish. I'm one of my bad faults. and that's right. And after the Johnson City thing, we said, fuck this whole thing. We went and got a rent-a-car.
And ladies and gentlemen, that is why 14-year-old Brian Last didn't get to know John McAdam that first year right there.
John is so aloof. That's correct. But I mean, what would be worse, that or me saying, hey, I better get to meet this 14-year-old boy, you know?
I know. It says a lot about Scott that he was willing to talk to me.
It sure does, doesn't it?
That's always been one of my better qualities.
I didn't think being on a certain registry was a good quality, but whatever you say.
But
go ahead.
Go ahead, Scott.
No, it just those were just so much fun, those trips, you know. All these wildly different personalities and people of different age ranges and things like that. There was bound to be a lot of crazy stuff going on. Nothing too out of control. But also, you know, a personality clashes here and there, you know, we all have that kind of stuff going on.
You have any good stories about personality clashes at Fan Week?
Even now it just doesn't seem fair to mention people's names. It's been so long, you know,
I'm not going to say the name either. There was definitely a certain fan who Ron Head took great joy in annoying. I don't even know if annoying is the right word. Tormenting?
Well, he brought it on himself, that particular fan.
Yes, he did.
That's something we still remember. And he's calmed out a lot. I see him on Facebook. There were some crazy stories involving that guy because he was really a little too tightly wound.
This is the guy that was told by Ron Head that, oh yeah, you're allowed to go into the Heels locker room. Go right ahead.
Well, he had some urgent piece of nonsensical, useless information that he had to tell somebody right then, you know, because the show couldn't go on. It wasn't like he just wanted to wander backstage and see people and half undressed. But, he just always thought, you know, this is urgent and I've got to clue everybody in. So, yeah, he went backstage and I think the story goes the first person he ran into was Tammy, who knew him well from Philly and New Jersey and already despised him. You know? So I think it's, she sees him first, then Brian Lee is right there, and he sees Tammy react, and
Brian Lee made the guy soil himself.
Right.
And what also was going on, because Ron Head and J.R. Benson were, and actually the future Stacy Cornette was in the middle of it. I mean, those guys were hilarious and relentless, and they knew he was bothered whenever you made a reference to Joey Morella's death. And, of course, that just made him do it more. So I'm sitting there with Steve Walsh and Brian Hildebrand, and this guy, he marches up to Brian. And he says, you know, you got to make sure those guys don't make any more Joey Morella jokes. And Walsh has had enough of this guy, and he just gets up and he puts his finger in his face and starts barking at him. And Hildebrand's got to break it up. So later, and I'm, of course, me, I'm just sitting there laughing, right? And Brian's like, yeah, thanks for helping out.
But then that guy would turn around and he'd make a Kerry Von Erich joke, and you're supposed to just, you didn't know where the line was.
There is no line. It's circular.
Yeah. Well, let's all keep that in mind when you hear the next TRNAC on the next episode. There is no line, and the views expressed by TRNAC don't necessarily represent those of the 605 Super Podcast or myself.
That works.
Yeah, But Scott, thank you, man. You've been great on here. You were great on the show we recorded earlier, which will go up a couple days after this. I shouldn't say a couple. A few days after this. I don't want people counting down the seconds, which will happen. But you've been a big part of the show in this last year in 2016. You'll be a big part of it in 2017. Hopefully we'll get this convention off the ground and we'll have our own fan week. And Happy New Year. Happy New Year, my friend.
Happy New Year to you, Brian. To you and your family. Happy New Year. Great to talk to you again, John. And I hope we.
It's been over 20 years. It's been excellent to talk to you again, man.
Yeah, we'll see you down the road.
Well, absolutely.
Take care, guys.
And hopefully, next time you guys talk, Kenny Bolin won't eat up 85%, 90% of the conversation. So
95, 98.
Kenny was gold. If he wasn't funny, you know. It would be a whole different story. That's a funny motherfucker right there. In a hospital bed, he's funny.
In a hospital bed, he's funny.
Good night, guys. Take care.
Good night.
Take care, Scott. And let's see. I'm going to go to my page. And Scott has left the call. John, it's now me and you. And we have to see who else is available for the remaining part of this show. Thank you for being a part of this.
No, man, thank you. What an incredible 2016 you have had. I barely knew who you were 12 months ago, and now you are part of my life 4 hours a week with the Super Podcast. You know what you've done? You have replaced Dave Meltzer's Yada Show. It took 15 years, but someone finally replaced it.
Wow, that's a heavy compliment, man. Thank you.
It is, man.
Thank you. And I really appreciate that. I that's like one of the things I take seriously when doing the show because, I come from the entertainment industry, but I also spent a lot of hours in my life in a car listening to Howard Stern or Mike and the Mad Dog or Opie and Anthony or various other shows. And I have had talk shows that I've loved. You know, there was various times in my life where I was obsessed with Letterman and I had to watch every night. There was Craig Ferguson I was crazy about. I love old talk shows that I think are good, like Dick Cavett and things like that. And I recognize that, you know, it's a special relationship you have when you host something and on the other end, someone is willing to allow you into their lives for however many hours a week, whether it's 5 days a week or whether this show, you know, 3 to 4 hours a week. It's very special. And, you know, over time, you build up a very special relationship with people that you've never actually talked to, never actually met. And I take it very seriously. And that's why I'm always so obsessed with just putting out as perfect a finished product, whether it's the show, whether it's the social media presence on Facebook, whether it's, you know, down to the packaging. When someone gets a 605 Super Podcast t-shirt, I want it to be like when you get an Apple computer. The packaging is nice. You open it up. Things are folded nice. You take it out of there. You know, to me, it's a whole big thing. And I guess it all just comes down to I have such an appreciation for what you just said and for the fact that anybody would, you know, welcome me and this show into their lives every single week for, you know, 4 hours a week.
Well, it's a great thing. And, you know, you've got your own, and I mean this in the most positive way possible. I mean, you've got your own cult. You've got your own Facebook page that, you know, it's nothing but 605 listeners and people are into the top 10 and into the bits. It's great.
It is. And, you know, one of my hopes is when we do this convention, you can come down because I think, the convention could be a lot of things. And one of the things it could be is for a lot of people like you or Tom Robinson or Scott Cornish, veterans of a UAWF or a fan week. It's an excuse. It's a reason. It's a way to get together again and be a part of something new. So
I'm thinking about it, and
you got months.
Based on your conversations with Robinson, I'm looking into personal trainers.
Aren't we all?
I mean, you guys are talking about getting buffed up for this thing. I'm like, what, is there going to be chicks there? Come on.
Well, you know what? Then maybe I could have Suzanne invite some of her friends.
Trust me, they won't be. As a veteran of the UAWF process, trust me.
Well, you may know something, but I think our next guest might be ready. And this is going to be a test because I don't know for sure if he is. And he's another one. I keep saying people have limited time and then they talk for about 2 hours on the show. But let's see. Let's see if we can add this guy. Add now. And it is ringing him. And his screen picture is a picture of him and Samoa Joe. And let's see. It's ringing. Still ringing.
Hey, Brian.
Yo, yo, yo. What's up? What's up? What's up?
Roy Lucier, how
That's
are you?
That's funny.
What's going on over there?
Not much. Just stepping out of the work area for a minute.
I probably should have told you we were already recording.
Oh, no, that's fine. That's fine. Okay, I am completely off the floor, and you have my attention.
Say hello to John McAdam.
Oh, John McAdam, awesome. How you doing today, Roy Lucier?
Hey, Roy, how are you, man?
Roy, can you hear him? Roy, can we hear you? Roy, do you have...
Roy, honey, is everything okay?
Now we're here. Can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay. How you? John asked how you were doing.
Mr. How you doing, John McAdam?
I'm fantastic, man. That was a great story you had about your appearance at AAA in Los Angeles.
Jeez. That definitely brings me back quite a few years.
Death wish, man.
Roy, you're still really involved
and I'm planning on doing it again later.
Boy, but Roy, I don't know if you can hear me. You're the first guest we've run into whose connection is bouncing in and out.
I'm about to jump on a different. Let me see.
This is captivating audio here, ladies and gentlemen. Roy, are you with us?
No! Will you get that stupid fool out of here? I don't want to see you around here anymore.
Okay.
Are you there?
All right, guys. Hey, I'm on my phone now. This should work a lot better.
All right. Say something so we can test this out and actually see if we could have a conversation.
Arriba la Rudos!
Now, John, you say something.
You know what my favorite Christmas angle was? These guys were talking about this yesterday. Definitely Jake Roberts dressed as Santa Claus Christmas 1982.
I was going to guess
that. It had never been done before, as far as I know. And you could see it. You could see it happening. You could see some department store Santa showing up at the wrestling matches dressed as Santa. And just being in the front row, and then something happens, and it had never been done before. I thought it was very creative.
Yeah, I mean, again, it goes back to my argument last time about Michael Hayes doing it in '83. You know, it's like, okay, you could see some department store Santa getting in there. How did he get the ringside? And what makes the baby face think, yeah, I'm going to celebrate with Santa?
You know what? Honest to God, I could have totally seen something like that at the Boston Garden, like 81, 82. You know, babyface sees a guy dressed as Santa and, hey, let's have some fun with this.
How big would that have been if it had happened, let's say there, let's say the Garden, and then replayed on TV to Backlund? If all of a sudden Backlund wins and Santa Claus comes out and it's, you know, whoever, it's Greg Valentine or, you know, it's someone we haven't seen in a while.
It would have been a legitimate riot.
The Santa riots of 1982.
Yeah, exactly.
Or imagine Mid-South, that Junkyard Dog is celebrating and Santa comes out and it's Michael Hayes.
Yeah, same thing. Same thing. So
the best part about Dallas was Bill Mercer saying, but I don't think that's really Santa Claus. I think that might be Michael Hayes.
That's the man who covered the Kennedy assassination.
And he'll years go on later, a limb there.
He's trying to figure out the identity of Santa Claus.
I've had people tell me that, like, oh, my God, my children were destroyed because this destroyed their image of Santa Claus. I'm like, you guys are dumb kids. You don't understand that Michael Hayes could buy a costume?
Yeah, you want to destroy their image of Santa Claus, go to the mall during lunch break.
Yeah, really?
Roy, were there any luchadors dressed like Santa?
Jeez, not that I can remember. AAA was pretty outlandish when it came to the characters. I mean, you had Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Power Rangers. They actually filed a lawsuit, and the Power Rangers had to change their name to the Power Raiders. But I don't, for the life of me, remember a Santa Claus ever in Lucha.
That's the one place you'd think one would fit, would be Lucha, but... I guess that, I mean, other than Jake and Michael Hayes, are there any other Santa moment? I'm not counting Santa Claus when Boo Bradley went into the WWE in the 90s, but are there any other Santa angles that I'm just not thinking of?
The Christmas creature.
The Christmas creature. That's true.
I know it didn't lead to anything and it was just for a one shot, but Tribute to the Troops used the Santa quite often.
Did he do, I mean, was he a heel Santa or was he just a Santa? What a ridiculous statement that is. Roy? You've lost Roy. Roy's appearance is going to go down in 605 Super Podcast.
That's my fault. I hit the mute button on accident. I think it was just Vince dressed as Santa just for the troops so Austin could stun him.
Oh, so it was a heel Santa. It was a heel yes. Santa, though. Well, let me ask you this, you know, talking about WWE, you went to an NXT show recently and took a bunch of pictures with various people wearing the 605 Super Podcast shirt, everyone from Shinsuke Nakamura to Dave Meltzer, which I really appreciate.
Always.
I don't think Dave had any idea what the show was, despite our multiple attempts to get him on the air. But
remember, I ended up talking to Meltzer and I said, hey, I talked to Brian last and he wanted to say thank you for the Hall of Fame ballot. And that's at the time he's all, well, can I say the name here? Is that okay?
Yeah, you could say it.
Yeah. Yeah. He said, well, Cornette asked me to do it.
There you go. So, Jim Cornette got me my Hall of Fame vote.
Yes.
So what a nice, and then he denied it. So he didn't even want the credit for it. So thank you, Jimmy Cornette. I played along, but I knew all along.
Another big Santa angle I just thought of.
Yeah.
Captain Lou Albano was in the end of 1984. He's dressed as Santa, yes. Or at least he's got a beard or something, and he's reading a poem, and the two kids turn around, and they're dressed like Lou Albano, and it made me say, oh, my God, they're going to turn Lou Albano babyface, and they did. And you have to understand, he was the biggest heel out here for 15 years, and they were turning him. So it was like, wow.
Yeah, I feel like, did he do a TNT appearance? Was that TNT where he was dressed like Santa?
It was TNT.
Yeah, that's the one I'm remembering.
TNT.
Yeah. Roy, was Lano at that NXT show?
He was not, and you're going to love this. He actually emailed me and said that unless he gets into the show for free, he's not going.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not kidding.
The jokes write themselves here at the 605. Oh, God.
Never change, Mike.
Perfect Ryan. Timing.
Never change.
did I tell you that Leno sent me a picture of me with the 100% Ruta sign at the Olympic in 94? And even for something like that, because I told him that I didn't have any, he put his watermark in the middle so you can't even make out like 50% of it.
Are you serious?
Yeah, dead serious.
Why would he do that?
Please post this on my Facebook page, please.
Yeah, post it to McAdams Group so we could all see it.
Yeah. That's you, seriously. Oh, there it is.
Yeah, we've caught him recently putting his watermark on a photo of Lord Littlebrook, which we know he didn't take. A photo of the Funks on their ranch in the mid-60s, which we know he didn't take. And it's a little bit of a reputation he's built as the false watermark doctor. Mike,
we should get a tribute or a tradition going with the 605 listeners to put a Lena watermark on the most outrageous thing that you can think of.
The Sapruder film.
Oh, you stole if you beat me by 1 second.
Were you really gonna go there?
I was gonna say the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah, photo by real
the pictures of, of Johnson being sworn in with Jackie with the bloodstains on her jacket with Elena watermark.
And his watermark is great because it's not just like photo by Mike Lano, it has his email address. In case you want to email him and license the photo he didn't take. Oh, what a funny guy. Roy, I know you're short on time tonight. So
no, I'm cool, man.
Are
I'm
you
good.
Cool? All right.
Yeah.
And actually, I just see that you sent me a photo here. And oh, here's the 100% Ruta. Wow, it really is just right across the middle of the picture.
I sent it to John.
Wow. All
right, that's going up.
By the way, he didn't even do it correctly because all you see is E-A-L-A-N-O and half of the at sign.
Oh my God.
Did you see this, John?
I am seeing it now. It looks like Albano. What the?
Roy, after the show goes up, this is going on the 605 page also, so all the listeners can see this.
Oh yeah.
In its full glory. In its full glory. Oh my God.
God, yeah, I was like a 20-year-old kid at the time. I'm 42 now, so it was 22 years ago and stuff like that. At the Olympic, I guess it was in one of the Gong or Pro or whatever one Lena worked with or whatever. And then, you know, we reconnected and we email each other here and there. And he said, I have an old photo of you. So I'm like, hey, can I get it? Big old watermark in the middle. It's like, dude, really?
See, at least the really bad photos I have that he took of me and Terry Funk at Terry's Ranch, he stamped them on the back. And now Bob Barnett just sent me a photo of Lano with, I don't know who this is. But this is all happening in real time, ladies and gentlemen. Who is that with Lano? Let's see what he says. Why am I typing this? Hold on, I'll add Bob to the call. Let me get his phone number here. Copy this. Copy. Go here. Current calls. Add Bob Barnett. Add. All right. Let's see if this works out. Let's see if we get him.
Well,
mushy, mushy.
How you doing?
Hey, you're on the air, and we're with John McAdam and Roy Lucier, whose name I butcher every time I attempt to say it.
He probably doesn't care.
Nope.
Well, we're saying to the listeners, you just sent this picture as we were talking about Lano. You sent a picture of Lano to me. Who is in this picture with him?
That's Vinnie Massaro, who was wrestling as far back as Roland Alexander when Lano was at his peak. And he's been a Lano fan for probably 20 years.
I actually don't know who he is.
He's a wrestler. He's a really good little wrestler. He's got a great looking wife. He's a really good guy, a real smart guy. And he gets it. Yeah, he gets Lano.
And I think we've lost McAdam. I think McAdam may have dropped off the call here. Hey, talk amongst probably yourselves, Bob and Roy. I'll be right back.
Yeah, how you doing, Roy?
Oh, pretty good. Just at work right now. A few minutes left. Brian asked me to jump into this, so I definitely wasn't going to say no to this. Especially,
yeah. Well, I'm really looking forward to seeing you guys at the end of February.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm taking my wife out all day long to San Francisco and stuff like that, and then you know, you just let me know what time to pick you up at that stop a half block away or half mile away or whatever, and I'll come get you and we'll go to the arena.
Yeah, okay. I'll let you know when I get on the train, because I don't know what happens up there.
Yeah, no problem. Just let me know what train or whatever, what time it gets there, and I got you right then.
Yeah.
Okay, McAdam had to drop off. He had a phone issue, so it's just us now, boys.
All right.
Okay.
Hiya, boys.
Well, what did I miss?
Well, you missed. Here's what you guys have missed so far on the show. We had Scott Cornish. We had Kenny Bolin in his hospital bed for about 50 minutes.
What's wrong with him?
I'm not exactly sure. He's leaking fluid, gallons and gallons of fluid. And apparently he's broken the Baptist Hospital record for most urine. But I didn't know they keep records like this on record, or yeah, however it works. So he was on, and then Bobby Blaze joined the show for a memorable segment, and now it's us.
Anything Blaze does is memorable. I lost count of how many F-bombs he dropped on that last episode.
Well, I got to be careful what I say, because I think my kids may still be up. I'm not sure, but he had a memorable one today when he said, that B is a C. So that one will be back in history.
Yeah, well, happy fucking New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year.
Same to you.
Happy New Year. And let me ask you, Bob, so we've heard Roy talk about, we've heard you talk about a little bit, now we have you both on the air. The famous night when Roy was chased all over the sports arena.
Oh, Jesus.
When did you realize that it was about to happen, or it was going to go completely crazy?
Well, he walked away from his seat, and I didn't know where he went. And then I saw him come down the next aisle over, and, you know, he didn't mind drawing heat. But then I saw him come down the second aisle, and I thought, uh-oh, we got a problem. And he could play the rest of it.
Yeah, LAPD, when they approached me, I mean, it was bad. I just remember standing there and just losing it and just yelling for Rudos and being, you know, hit with everything left and right that wasn't tied down, and walking up there when LAPD told me, sorry, we've been told you got to get out of here, or we got to take you out. It was like, I didn't expect it.
Well, the best part was you were wearing a white shirt, so everything you got thrown at you ended up showing up.
Yeah, I think I was LDS at the time, and there was like a fireside or something earlier in the day, and I think I just left there to come over there. So yeah, I had a white shirt, you know,
white dress shirt. Yeah,
white dress shirt. Yeah, even with my glasses on and stuff like that. Oh, geez, I was just getting bombarded.
I figure you got hit about between 60 and 100 times before you got back to me again.
At that point, you're like, dude, get the hell away from me.
Yeah, because when you came back to me, you were just ripping mustard.
So what were those LA shows? I mean, legitimately, how many gringos or smart fans were actually there? Because we know Dave Meltzer went to some of those shows. And like, how many of you guys, you observer readers, were actually there that you know of?
30 to 35?
Well, at least, yeah, they were in one section, because I used to buy a ton of tickets at once for everybody. So pretty much all the smart-ass guys were sitting in one section.
You had Ron Rivera and, you know, his friends like Hernan, Kevin, those guys and stuff. You had, you know,
John Williams,
Steve Gerber, John Williams. Occasionally, guys like Wade Keller would fly in for the shows too.
Yeah, Keller and Mitchell came in for one show. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember meeting them, and you know, I was subscribing to the Torch at the time. So that was kind of a huge deal.
Bob, Roy discussed a little bit last time he was on the show, the World Wrestling Peace Festival that Antonio Inoki promoted. I've never talked to you about that on the air. What are your memories of that event?
Well, I had 103 fever that night. But the best part was leading up to it, because you know who was out pounding the streets giving out posters. He was walking around Japantown So not only couldn't he be understood, nobody knew what the hell he was doing. And he was sort of forcing the posters onto the front windows of all these stores, many of which had nothing to do with, you know, Pearl Russell. And he just tried to be a real big part of the whole festival. I remember being in the office, and you couldn't get him out. You know, he was going to get promoted to some sort of a fictional position before the thing happened.
Roy, what is someone cracking a soda over there?
Oh, yeah, I'm in my break room at work.
It's like I hear all sorts of things going on behind you, and I'm like, what the hell's happening?
Yeah, I'm in a nice quiet room watching the Ducks get beat again. But leading up to it, there wasn't really a buzz. And Inoki came to town with God, who was his big pal?
KGB.
Huh?
Remember, Inoki did the press conference January 16th. He brought like KGB, Antonio Pena, Sakaguchi, and
Sakaguchi. Yeah, I met Sakaguchi. That's right.
And Jimmy Inoki Suzuki.
Jimmy was around all the time, but Inoki was very talkative at the festival. He was willing to talk to anybody. And but there was something going on right across the street at Grauman's or near Grauman's that took the whole shine away from the press conference. The press conference got no coverage whatsoever.
Which was shocking, considering that. Didn't they have like AAA and CMLL at the same press conference, which, you know, that's bigger than, you know, WCW and WWF having something joint at the same time during the Monday Night Wars.
Yeah, it would have been if somebody wrote about it, but nobody.
Yeah.
Nobody wrote about it. I mean, Meltzer flew down that day. Everybody that was connected with wrestling that knew about it was there, and they just didn't get a dime's worth of coverage. I just can't remember. There was something going on across at Grauman's that day that took away all the heat. We kept looking out the window. Even Inoki was looking out the window.
I'll take a search of the day before May 31st, 96, and see what was going on big that day. But I remember they were trying to paper the market like you wouldn't believe, and they still couldn't even fill half of the building.
Yeah, it was real, and WCW didn't give it any publicity at all.
No, that would have helped time if they had done that.
Yeah, I think what, there were maybe 3,000 people in the building, 3,500, like that, any of them paid. And I was just sick as a dog, but I had to see the show. I mean, the show just seemed like it was going to be great, but, you know, a lot of the matches were real short, and you know, a lot of guys didn't want to go over, and, you know, and there was a lot of guys were trying out for Bischoff, who was sitting there at ringside. They never released a commercial video of that thing. And somebody said they did, but I've never seen it. They had 11 cameras.
It sounds like there's a hardcore match going on behind Roy.
Now, I talked to Bob Cardigo multiple times about it, and there is no pro shot of it. That exists.
Never edited it, or they just didn't think it was worth putting out.
Yeah, I guess that either, you know, rights, or someone was going to ask about copyright or what the deal was. I have two different versions of it. I handled from the stands, and then like a pro shot without commentary that's got all but the WCW matches on it.
That's probably his then. Yeah, I shot it from about the 10th row. I got a pretty good video of every match except one. That was a one match where I was just about losing it. But, yeah, it was a great show, and nobody was there. It was the weirdest thing.
Well,
I got both of those shots, by the way, on my YouTube channel.
Well, why don't you plug your channel here for the listeners, Roy?
Okay, I got a YouTube channel. I got a couple different ones. One I mostly do for my stuff just to upload in pastime. I got another one where I'm currently doing a videotape. how should I put this? I'm doing a big project with my old collection and Ron Head's tape collection. And Ron Head went ahead and bought multiple people's tape collections, from Barry Rose to a Mid-South collections and stuff like that. but this is probably a little over 13,000 tapes. So what I do is I have a friend who wrestled in ECW as Chad Austin, and he's burning 50 tapes at a time, sending those DVDs to me after they're burnt, and then I upload them on my YouTube channels. So if you like Google my name, Roy Lusher, you'll see like three different channels. One's with New Japan matches, one's with Japan matches, and then there's another one for like everything other than that.
13,000 tapes. I thought I had a lot of tapes.
Yes, 13,000 tapes.
Bob.
That's crazy.
It's amazing. That's crazy. First of all, how do you store them? I mean, before you send them to Chad to have them converted, do you actually just go out and get a storage unit just to house this collection?
They are in a friend of Ron Head's. How should I say this? Like Ron Head has a friend who has a basement in Philadelphia with 7,000 of the tapes, and he sends them to Chad 50 at a time. Also, my mother in Lake Havasu, who has my tape collection, sends them 50 at a time to Chad as well.
That's expensive as hell to ship even 50 tapes.
Yeah, it's 15 to 20 bucks a shot.
Holy cow.
Well, how much of the collection was yours and how much of it was Ron's of the 13,000?
I want to say 7,000 was Ron, 6,000 was mine.
Wow. And you said that Ron had collections like Barry Rose's. Any other notable collections that Ron had?
He had a Buddy Rose collection, the Portland guy. I guess when Buddy passed away, that he left he left some tapes behind or something like that. Maybe they've been floating around, but a lot of these matches, when I put them on when I search if the match already exists on the internet, I can't find it anywhere. But I've been told by some people that like Matthew Mertz, who runs the Portland YouTube page, that the tapes float around, but nobody's uploaded them.
Huh, yeah, wow. I have a bunch of that stuff in the story I got. It was Buddy Rose's beta collection, that after he passed away, his beta tapes got into circulation. So Ron actually has those master beta tapes, or had those master beta tapes?
Yes.
Wow, okay.
Wow. Yeah, Ron lives in Louisville now, right?
Yeah, he's actually the ring announcer for OVW. Cornette got him the job when Cornette was still a part of OVW, and Ron has never left there since.
Hey, that's a long time ago.
Yeah, I talk to Ron on a regular basis, weekly. So, yeah, I always touch base with him, you know, not just about the tapes, but, he just recently had, throat surgery. Recovering from that and stuff, so, yeah.
That's
where did he work? He should be a manager by now. He's a real smart guy.
And by the way, Roy, next time you talk to him, tell him he should come on the Super Podcast and discuss Lano sometime.
I will do that. Didn't I tell you, or I sent you that video of Ron behind the scenes stuff, of his stuff in Hollywood with Dan Farron's promotion, and you could see him trying to film and stuff like that. As Sabu's coming to the ring, all you see is Lano in the way.
I got to see that stuff. That was a great promotion.
I'll send it to you. I got actually.
Just put it online and let me know when it's up there. That's all. That's great.
Yeah. It's Dan Severn against Doug Williams in a UFC style match that lasted 28 seconds. And Severn does this promotion that lasts 15 minutes beforehand. That's just gold. I mean, it's so bad, it's good. I mean, it's not like any crease so bad, but it's pretty bad.
Where were those shows? Where were they?
Hollywood.
Those are really, I never saw Severn at the Hollywood shows.
Yeah, it was the same show as Osama Nishimura against Al Snow.
God, I don't remember it. I remember the one show when Nashville Pussy was playing, and what's her name? The 6'2" girl was standing right in front of me with a miniskirt up to her crotch, and she had no underwear on. I said, that was just one of the greatest views I've ever had. What's her name? She was a her brother was in the NBA. Christian Laettner. Yeah. His sister.
Man. Hey, Bob, how big was the Steve Minari collection?
It was about 4,500 tapes, but he didn't send me them all.
Right.
Minari was out of his... Yeah, Minari was out of his mind. It took me months and months to get him to even admit that he'd sell it, and I never talked price to him. And then I went to the Sam Mushnick convention put on by you know who, and everybody was in the bar that night, including Lou Thesz. So the night started out with Minari. He had an unedited copy of Lou Thesz's biography and had a lot of real sleaze that Lou put in. His wife really edited the hell out of Lou's book. And Minari brought it out to the coffee shop, made me speed read it to see some of the stuff that was in there. I mean, he really ripped some people, especially Antonino Rocca. He just hated Rocca.
So Buddy Rogers, that, too.
Yeah, a lot of people. But, I mean, it was all in the book, and it just blew my mind because it didn't make it to the printing. And then Minari sat there with me, and first he wanted like $10,000 for the tapes. And I knew what the quality was. I said, you're out of your mind. And I started to get up to leave. He goes, well, wait a second. And then all of a sudden the price went down to $5,000. And after figuring out how many tapes he had, I offered him $4,500. And he sent me the tapes a couple of weeks later. Of course, they were wrapped like a lunatic had wrapped them. And I think it was about 3,800 tapes. I think he kept a couple tapes. He swore he didn't, but I'm pretty sure some of the stuff he just wouldn't let me have. So at that time, some guys thought their ownership of the tapes, they just didn't want anybody to see them. They're real, real sick about that stuff. There was a guy in Japan like that who would never let anybody see his tapes, especially the stuff from the Olympic Auditorium.
Man.
Yeah, it was quite a collection, but I mean, a lot of it wasn't in great shape. It's just that he had stuff at the time that was really, really rare, and then later on it all started surfacing.
Did Rock Rims end up buying that collection?
I don't know who ended up. I can't even remember. I think I sold it off for about $1,000 or $2,000, but you know, I made a fortune on it over the years until it turned out that there were ways to get most of his tapes in better quality.
Hey, Roy, do me a favor. Try to mute yourself when you're not talking because I'm getting a ton of noise from your end.
You got it.
Yeah, a ton of noise. I got the Mid-South collection, the Minari Mid-South stuff I got from you, Bob. And,
yeah,
you know, it's very similar to what you said. That was like the best Mid-South collection out there until the Watts family started putting stuff out. And to be honest, a lot of the episodes from the Minari collection were better quality. The quality's off the master tapes, which surprised me. And of course, the one added benefit was you got all the localized promos, which are now, you know, gone. Because most of these promoters didn't save the local promos. They only saved, if they saved anything, they only saved the shows.
The tapes that were the best quality were the ones made by Dickie Bourne. I think they were made for a New Orleans station.
Yeah.
And those were real good quality. But a lot of the stuff he had was, you know... It was weird. I mean, you've got that. I can't remember if he had it or you had it. Was that tape of Watch shows outside somewhere in the afternoon?
No, that was part of the Minari collection. That was WrestleFest 85.
Yeah, and you got to put that up or I got to get a copy of that. I lost mine. I could never find it.
Yeah, I have that somewhere. Eddie's on that show. Wahoo's on that show. It's
yeah,
pretty strange.
Yeah, it was a loaded up show for an after. It was like a State Fair or something. But anyway, I mean, Minari was a real trip. I gave him the dough that he had a stroke. So he had a lot of problems and he had a kid that he could barely afford to feed. And he took the $4,500 and bought a drum set. He spent almost the entire amount on a drum set. I couldn't figure him out.
I actually tried to get in touch with him not too long ago because I found a Facebook page for Steve Minari. And it was a guy sitting behind a drum set. So I was like, oh, it has to be him.
Yeah, it had to be him, especially if he had long hair. But he just stopped communicating with people, which was weird. Because he used to write single-spaced letters that went on for pages and pages. Every time I get tapes from him, I get a book. I don't have it all now. I don't know if I gave it to John Williams or something, but he wrote so much stuff because he used to know so many guys, and he had all these stories about how he got the tapes or talking to guys between shows. He was, I think he talked to Bruiser Brody a lot, and he just knew a lot of people. I don't know how he got so connected, but by the time I met him, he was connected everywhere.
Yeah, that was the thing, because when I started dealing with him in the 90s, after he'd already sold the collection to you, he would send me these long letters, but also he still had some stuff. And the stuff that I know he had was the Brody stuff, and the story, from what I remember, was that him and Brody were actually really close. Or at least
I think Mick Foley went through Minari to get Brody tapes. I think Foley was pretty good friends with Minari. Yeah, I don't know if I've got all the Brody. I mean, I've got a lot of Brody stuff, but I don't know what he held back. His most valuable tape, and the one he never sent me the original, was Dory and Terry Funk in Japan. And later on, it came out, you know, in the original version. Yeah, really, really sounds like Roy's having a party back there.
I got it muted when I got it muted when I'm not on.
Oh, okay. I think we lost Brian.
I'm right here. Oh, okay. Well, you know, this is turning into a disaster here at the end of the show, so I think it's time to end the show, the New Year's special of the Super Podcast.
Yeah, well, we should have a show after we all, some of us get together in Northern California in February. We'll probably have a lot to say, and there'll probably be a lot of jokes flying back and forth, especially if we get Lano into the show.
I tried to talk Gabriel Ramirez into it, and he's just like, I don't want him at my show.
Yeah, I gotta keep telling Gabe, I want him at your show, but
yeah, he's Barnett tells me, screw Ultimo, I want Lano.
Yeah, I don't care about seeing Ultimo Dragon, I'd rather see Lano. Who's gonna give me more laughs?
Well, all right. We'll definitely talk to you guys again after that, and hopefully there are some new stories. But I'm going to now, Roy, let me let you go first, and I'll keep Bob on for a second, just so I can end the show without the party going on behind you.
Yeah, I've stepped as far away from everything as I can, but no, I appreciate you having me on. I really do.
No, thanks for doing it, man.
And one thing, I want to let it be known out there, if there are listeners out there that have old VHS tapes and what they have on there is pure gold. I mean, you're talking about something that is not on YouTube, not anywhere, but you have no way to get it over to DVD. Message me, get a hold of me, whatever. And if it's literally something that, you know, that is rare, I'll take care of it for free. You know, just get it in my hands, and if you want the tape back, I'll get it to you. And if you want an extra DVD, I'll send that to you too. But, you know, I'm putting that offer out there because I understand we're in a period now where we want to get rid of all the VHS tapes and transfer them to DVD. And, you know, if I could do that, I'll do it.
Yeah, I should have sold my collection years ago because now I'm sitting on all these tapes.
And you can't sell them. I mean, nobody will buy them.
I probably could, but I'd have to put time and effort into it, which, you know, I don't really want to do. But I found, like, a box the other day with, you know, taped off television because I had a good source in Japan, like Champ Forum from, like, 1996, 1997 maybe. You know,
great stuff.
Perfect quality. Yeah. And, you know, it's like I'm sure someone would buy it, but I got to, you know, it's more work than – I probably, you know, have the time to do.
Yeah, a lot of that stuff was good. Lightning Kid was over there, yeah.
It was after that, I think. It's when Michinoku is really hitting its peak. And also it's FMW, it's IWA, it's, whatever was happening on the women's scene. It's basically everything other than New Japan and All Japan.
Yeah, that was big 94, 95. So it had to be that time frame.
Yeah, that's exactly when it was.
Yeah,
I would say starting late 95 and then most of 96, I have like off tele. I had the person tape it off television and send me the tape. So it's not even a dub.
That's great.
And I want to throw this out there, by the way, because I know Bobby Blaze will be listening. Hey, buy his fucking book.
You just made him a happy man. Well, Roy, thanks for being a part of this today. And we'll talk to you soon.
Anytime. Thanks a lot for having me on, Brian.
All right. Take it easy. And I wanted to end the show without all that noise behind him. I know Roy probably doesn't realize how much noise was actually there. And, you know, one of my goals.
He manages a really big Target store. There's probably a shitload of people there.
Yeah. And, you know, my goal with these shows is very minimal editing for these special holiday shows. And this show is going to really put that to the test.
Yeah,
a few times here, but we'll end with me and you, two old friends sitting here talking Lano, and I hope you do get to see him. I mean, let me ask you in advance of this potential encounter, how do you envision? I mean, do you envision him being someone who can let go of the lawsuit and everything else and just talk to you civilly? I mean, I know you could probably do that to him, but do you think he could do that to you?
Oh yeah, I would just act like nothing ever happened. Yeah, I mean I would just walk up to the guy, he'd do a mic, and he'd probably start talking to me right away because he really doesn't have many people to talk about, you know, what he knows. So he'd probably be okay. And if you saw Lucier up there, and Lucier started, he'd probably forget a lot of stuff pretty quick. But if he got in front of Matt, man might lose his marbles because I don't think he's a real fan of Lano, but I think it would work out. It would be a lot of laughs.
I need to get him on the show these days.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even really care if it's a good show. I'd rather just him be there, and that would make it a good show.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm going to have to get him on the show at some point in 2017.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, maybe you could put that together. Yeah. Maybe you could be the person to make that happen.
I wish there was a way I could figure out how to do it. I don't know. You know, the first thing you got to find out is what he knows about the show.
Yeah.
And then you'd probably have to give him all these conditions. Well, Barnett wouldn't be on the show, and so-and-so would be on the show, and nobody's going to call it. It's just you and me. I want to have a long conversation.
And I can agree to all that. I can agree to all that. Look, the only restrictions I won't allow him or any guest to place on me is you can't talk to me about this or you can't ask me about this. That I'll never agree to. But if he says, hey, you can't have Bob Barnett on with me, I'll agree to that, hoping that eventually he changes his mind.
Oh, sure.
If he says, you know, you can't do that, like, that's my one restriction is you can't tell me what I can or can't ask you. I'm not going to.
I don't think he would do that.
No, he would rationalize everything. Yeah.
Well, and he's not smart enough to do that. So, I don't know. You know, I just don't know. The big question is, has he heard the show? I mean, we just don't know.
Well, if he hasn't, he certainly will in 2017. And with that, I want to wish all the listeners of the Super Podcast a very happy new year. This is the final show that's going up in 2016, and 2016 has been a pretty remarkable year for me, my family, and the success of this show. So thank you all. Thank you all so much. And we have a lot of really cool big things planned for 2017. So everyone who's worn a t-shirt, everyone who's used our Amazon link, everyone who's told a friend about this show, everyone who's communicated and joined the community at facebook.com/superpodcast. Thank you so much from the bottom of my heart. It means a lot. 2016 has been great for us. And 2017 is going to be even better. So for the last time in 2016, tally-ho!
This is Vince McMahon wishing you all a very happy, joyous, and certainly prosperous and healthy Happy New Year. Any number of wrestlers in the World Wrestling Federation would also like to extend their best wishes for a Happy New Year, as well as their individual resolutions for the new year.
Hello, my name is Iron Mike Sharp, and I'd like to wish everybody out there a very Happy New Year. And my personal New Year's resolution is, I am not going to get upset when people call me a wimp. It's all behind me. I've decided that this is just a psychological tool that the people use against me, and I'm not going to get upset.
Hello, my name is Tony Guerrero, and I'd like to wish
each and every one of you a Happy New Year. What I would like for the coming year is a better understanding between men all over the world.
This is a Russian bear. I don't have to tell you that. I'm sure everybody knows this already. This TV reached all over the world. But I want to tell my home people the happiest New Year. The rest of the world I don't care about. They better have already celebrated all they can, because they're not going to have much more time to celebrate anything. Because pretty soon, you know, the superior will control everything. So, Happy New Year, comrades.
This is Rocky Johnson. I just want to take this opportunity to wish all my fans and friends a very Happy New Year. My New Year's revolution is very simple. Tony and myself, we want to be the best tag team champions there are. We're going to defend our belts against anybody, but most important, without you fans, there would be no Rocky Johnson or Tony Atlas. So I just want to thank all of you.
Samoa, Oma Uanges, Sika Mafa, Mafakuskala, Manguia, Kaku, Kausanfo, Manguia Kamam Kinga, Usum Kufa Fingin, the Famanguia, my foot, my word, my confide Kaku Kalonga. Kaya Maguia Lava, Kamam Kiga, Mosum Kuba Finger Sabo Uba, Kausanfo, Yamaguia Lava, Kowaso, Maguia Christmas, Happy New Year.
My name, as you all know, is Sergeant Slaughter, and I'd like to take this time to wish you all a very Happy New Year. You know what my New Year's resolution is? Cobra Corps in 84.
Happy New Year. This is Captain Lou Albano out there. I want to make a new resolution. I want all the little kiddies of America to look up to the captain, and I want you to follow in my ways. I want you to idolize me. I want you to do what I do. I want you to walk down the streets and say, I want to be another Captain Lou Albano. That's my resolution, to set a fine example for all the little punks of America. I want them all in my corner. Captain will show you the way, brother. Take a look at my face. Just imitate the captain. Do what the captain does.
This is Chief J. Strongo wishing each and every one of you a Happy New Year and many, many more. And my New Year's resolution is to keep going strong and keep doing the things that I think that my fans would like to see here. Like I say again, Happy New Year to all of you.
This is Gorilla Monsoon. I want to take this opportunity to wish everyone out there in TV land a healthy and happy and prosperous New Year. My New Year's resolution for 1984 is, in my own way, try to make this world a little better place to live in.
I'm the superstar, and I want to wish everybody a very happy and prosperous New Year. I made a resolution for myself to continue positive thinking. I know that 1984 is going to be my best year ever.
Happy New Year, all American. For Japanese, Mazazoni. Eat plenty, be strong.
For Japanese, let me tell you, American. Me, resolution like it. Lot American. Last American, turn Japanese.
Mi nombre es Tito Santana y quiero desearle a todos los latinos un próspero año nuevo para todos ustedes que me están escuchando. Lo que voy a hacer yo en 1988 es quitarle el título a Dan Morocco para toda la gente latina que me está escuchando, porque yo los represento a todos ustedes. I want to wish everybody a very happy New Year's, and I'm going to win the belt from Morocco once and for all in 1984, and I want to be the new champion for the people.
Again, from all of us here at the World Wrestling Federation, we wish you a very happy New Year.